You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
I'm currently on a book tour around the United States and hope to see you. Find the schedule of my events at warisalie.org. It is my privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, who has taught in the Native American Studies program at California State University Hayward and helped found the departments of Ethnic Studies and Women's Studies. Her 1977 book, The Great Sioux Nation, was the fundamental document at the first International Conference on Indigenous Peoples of the Americas, held at the United Nations headquarters in Geneva. Dunbar Ortiz is the author or editor of seven other books, including Roots of Resistance, A History of Land Tenure in New Mexico, and including An Indigenous People's History of the United States. Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you, David. I'm happy to be on your radio station.
I'm very glad to have you on. I was very interested in a statement that you put out last week that I saw from the Institute for Public Accuracy. The New York Times had claimed in a recent article that President Obama, quote, has now been at war longer than any other president. And you objected to that claim. Is that not accurate?
Well, it's very deceptive because, first of all, he's not really the first. James Monroe was his entire two terms was engulfed in the first war, and it was a declared war by Congress.
The first Seminole War,
Seminole Nation in Florida, which was actually claimed by Spain at the time, and the war was taking place sort of illegally over, a European international boundary. But then they just annexed Florida from Spain after that war.
I'm speaking to you from Charlottesville, Virginia, about 2 miles from James Monroe's house, and I don't think anybody has any idea who he was. But wars against Native Americans went on for decades. James Monroe can't be the only U.S. president who was at war his entire tenure.
Well, absolutely not. In fact, there were three wars against the Seminoles. The first one started in 1816, and then there were two others under, I think, altogether five different presidents up until 1858. So this was actually a sort of, if you look at like the Gulf Wars, the Iraq War since 1990, if you count that, which I do because they had a no-fly zone all during the 90s and then invaded again in 2003, and that still goes on. That's kind of like the Seminole Wars. There were some breaks from all-out war, but a continuous from 1816 to 1858. And very few people even know about it. But actually, the United States was in their Revolutionary War, the War of Independence. They had been as colonialists, fighting the Native nations, who were all agricultural nations east of the Mississippi. And they did counterinsurgency because the only means that the Native people, like Vietnamese peasants or others, the only means they have to fight is by guerrilla warfare and trying to protect their villages and their food and so forth. So counterinsurgency was actually invented in the colonial period by the settlers themselves. The British Empire, they didn't have a bunch of redcoats running around, They were pretty much autonomous on their own. And it was only when the British cut off their expansion after the 13 colonies were established, and that was in 1753, after a huge war, 7 years war with France, they cut off any further expansion in North America. And that's when, when the settlers rebelled, and declared independence, but all during that 10-year War of Independence, they were mostly fighting Native nations because they were invading and occupying their territories outside of the colonial boundaries. And that just continued without a beat. The Seminole War wasn't the first full-scale war. The first full-scale war was against the Shawnee Nation in Ohio, and that was the leader Tecumseh that's identified with that. That was about an 8-year war, and they drove those, you know, the Shawnees out of the Ohio Valley, and they joined with the Creek Muscogees in the south and resisting expansion into Georgia to beyond the first 13 colonies in Tennessee, Kentucky. And then when their villages were burned, their food supplies, their fields burned and run out, they took refuge. So this Seminole nation that developed from all of those resistors of the previous 20 years, they called themselves then, or they were called by the Spanish at first, Seminole, the kind of corruption of a Spanish word, Seminole, for renegades, you know, rebels. And so they were a combination of different peoples, and they fought on. They never did sign a treaty. They never did lose their territory. They still have it. Finally, the United States just stopped fighting them and left them there. It wasn't really territory. After the Civil War, it was sort of a moot thing because their main complaint, I think they probably would have given the Everglades to the Seminoles anyway, rather than all those wars. What it was really about was it was an escape for enslaved Africans. They had a maroon freedom place for enslaved Africans. There were thousands and thousands of Africans. And in that first war, all they demanded that they hand over all of the black people among themselves. And they said no, because by then they had intermarried. The Seminole Nation was this, you know, really this mixture of all kinds of different rebels, including some white sharecropper, you know, non-landholding white people who joined them. So that's a little known thing, but that's what that war was about. It was about not allowing any escape from slavery as they then moved into Alabama and Mississippi and built the Cotton Kingdom, the basis of U.S. capitalism, and became really like concentration camp slavery. Not that it was benign before, but it became truly a kind of concentration camp of work and of course, breeding slaves domestically in Virginia, marching them over there. It was slavery got much worse. You think it can't get worse. Slavery is bad, but it got much worse. And that's really that limitation. It delayed it. You know, the Seminole War certainly hobbled that development, but it went on. So then they continued, you know, after the Civil War, all during the Civil War, they moved out into the plains and into the former Mexican territory. Half of Mexico was taken in 1848 for the invasion of Mexico City. They had to relinquish half their territory, the Northern Territory. But there were Native people there who had never been colonized, the Navajos and the Comanches and the Hopi, Apaches. And so those wars, you know, famously Geronimo and others, those wars went on for 20 years. this war against Geronimo, people fought for 20 years. So, you know, if you leave out the first century of U.S. history completely, say that doesn't, you know, that isn't relevant to anything today, then you could say, I guess, that President Obama or whoever in the 20th century have carried on wars as if it's exceptional. And instead, it's the rule. I posted on Facebook once, asked others if they could find it. People came up with a few days, but I don't think there's a day in U.S. history from its founding until the present that the United States has not been aggressively at war with people of a foreign nation. Now you have to then realize that Native nations were foreign nations. They were actually indigenous nations, but they were foreign and recognized as such by the United States. So that's, you know, it's a warmongering nation. It goes to its very founding, its very DNA, and we don't admit that, so we keep wondering, you know, why are we doing this? Why are we invading anywhere? And generations forget that even the recent past, like Vietnam, and think this is all something new. So it's consistent and it's constant. It's the whole basis of the formation of the U.S. military are those, you know, that 100 years war. It was really a 100 years war against the native people of North America.
We're speaking with Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz. It seems like the tendency among different groups and people in the U.S. public is to say that this U.S. warmongering really started in 2001 or 2003 or 1947 or 1898. But it sounds to me like you're suggesting the more accurate way to look at it is that it began before even the beginning of the United States, and that the Revolution was an imperial war for expansion, and that the expansion has been continuing ever since. Is that how we should basically be seeing it?
Yes, that's really the accurate history of the United States, and it's, you know, it's not that it's secret information. U.S. historians know this. I was trained in history. I have a doctorate in history and from the 60s when my training went on. They know it, but they put it all in, you know, in the documentation that they do in books. It's that they justify it. They don't put it in the context of U.S. being a colonialist and an imperialist state. It's only recently that they're admitting it's imperial, you know, talking about imperialism, as if that was this very brief period of time, an anomaly of invading the Philippines and then, you know, and Teddy Roosevelt, Cuba, and then, you know, it wasn't even an empire anymore. But it was an empire from the beginning, you know, it was a split in the British Empire, and of course the United States Empire eventually took over. It was part of the Anglo Empire, and it's such an obvious history, but the mythology of the United States, the narrative that we're told and that gets repeated, and it's almost criminal to go beyond the parameters of that narrative very far. And even the left wing in this country from the very beginning has never really gone outside the boundaries of the narrative of a independent public, republic being born, a very tiny place that then became very powerful because it was, you know, immigration, nation of immigrants, narrative comes in, and that all these things came about that kind of corrupted it, you know, that,
yeah.
So it's then there's this tendency to say, let's get back to the real roots of the United States, what it really intended to be, and find a model for making it better. But we have to understand that's impossible, because it's not that, you know, there's never anything good in the beginning. It's just that the United States was founded as an empire and as a capitalist state, almost as a corporation. You know, it was the Constitution is, you know, is fundamentally the protection of private property. And the private property was land and African bodies. Those were the two commodities.
Yeah.
And it's not that, you know, it's frustrating because it's not just being even-handed. On the contrary, multiculturalism itself, you know, the most recent iteration of reforming U.S. history, has the same problem, because that then is contribution. How the contributions of African slaves to the wealth of this nation, that they built the, you know, built the White House, built Washington, D.C., made it greater. And there you have to literally make the Native people invisible, or it's a comical, you know, it's a comical narrative. And so that's what's done. It's basically just sort of plugging in a few instances, even in Howard Zinn. He has a kind of original sins that he acknowledges from the very beginning, as, you know, slavery and Indian genocide, which was very controversial when he did it in 1980, even though many of us had been doing that. We didn't get published, but Native Americans always did know that. African Americans always did know that. But it was very controversial, his book in 1980. And so it's a great contribution, but he then has that what we have now, or what we had in 1980 when he published it, was a history of struggle to create something. And again, not recognizing the limitations of consciousness in a settler with a settler colonial framework, you know, forming the working class so that everyone is bourgeois or seeks to be middle class. We call working people middle class, not working class. And so we had the United States was, it is true, you know, that the there should have been a revolution in the United States first. Marx actually wrote during the Civil War that wouldn't happen because the working class was stunted in the United States by the existence of slavery. And he made the same argument that he made about the British working class being stunted by its colonization of Ireland. But he didn't bring up settler colonialism either, you know, and which would have been the true analogy to Ireland. So that even Marxism in the United States is always, you know, excluded or not included or not considered the land question, the land being taken, or even Africans as property. If more Africans as labor, you know, Africans
right.
as conscripted labor rather than African bodies being sold. I mean, the stock market in the 1840s was based on property and African bodies and land, you know, commodities, the real estate that was taken and cut up and made into paper to buy and sell. Land as a commodity. That had never happened before in human history. Sure, there were big landowners and all. It was all common property, common law, but not cutting it up and making it into paper commodities to be bought and sold, and the bodies to be bought and sold. So to get credit in the Cotton Kingdom or in the North, the credit came, you could trade in this paper that represented you know, these the paper that represented human bodies, African bodies, or land. So we have to really digest that and understand what that means about our social psychology. And the denial that happens is just devastating for any kind of changing anything, because if we don't even know what it is, how can we change it? So it's really most frustrating on the left. People are really more than happy to jump in and say the U.S. is a terrible place, and I'm not going to vote, and I hate it, and yes, there was genocide, yes, there was slavery. But that doesn't change anything. You know, that's not really acknowledging your own role. You know, the fact that, you know, you're a part of this. You can't just, and that's been the tendency in the United States, is for utopian movements or even labor unions, for them all to get atomized, or say the Mormons or these religious groups, some of which were very interesting, like the Shakers, which were all women, and, you know, kind of pre-feminist and common property. But they're all autonomous utopianists and not really changing the whole society. So it's really become, I think, life or death, certainly as a planet, whether or not we get this and really start rethinking our whole strategies and analysis of how to halt it, because it's like a steamroller. We haven't even slowed it down. You know, we've made all these social changes. I mean, this beast can absorb almost anything and just keep going, you know, because we're not getting to the root of the problem.
And I think part of the root of the problem is what you have exposed here in war being present from the beginning. And I think it's a huge contradiction in that the U.S. military talks still to this day about moving out into Indian territory abroad, and the Apache helicopters and all the weapons named for the Native Americans. And yet the current president is supposedly the longest war president. The Afghanistan war, supposedly the longest war. The U.S. Civil War, supposedly the deadliest, most murderous war. And as if, you know, the Native Americans don't quite really count. And so the military celebrates them as the first victims, but erases them from history and from the statistics. And even people on the left who want to abolish war talk about war getting really bad post-World War II with weapons of mass destruction, and it's the weaponry that makes war really bad, and it has the higher casualties and the higher tolls for civilians. When wars in the 19th century, 18th century, were all about slaughtering civilians.
Oh, God, 500,000 people in the Civil War, that's no small number. And that were, you know, it wasn't like World War One, where most people died of flu.
Right, but even if it was 750,000, it wasn't what was done to the Philippines. It wasn't what was done to Vietnam. It wasn't what was done to Iraq. And it wasn't what was done to the Native Americans.
Yeah, but there were... you know, I think, this dating the United States, the other thing they leave out, even though it's always there, it's always in textbooks, but because there's no way to fit it in, it's just sort of ignored, are the Barbary Wars under Jefferson.
Yeah, who also lives 2 miles from here.
Yeah, and the Barbary Wars were... You know, if you have this narrative, this is this scrappy little colony, they've just come out of 10 years, these little colonies, they've come out of 10 years of devastating war, you know, to be independent, and they have to, you know, then get busy and try to create a new nation, write the Constitution, they're all in these halls doing that, and suddenly they have warships in the Mediterranean, shelling the Berber people, for free trade so that they don't have to pay a toll to go through their territorial waters.
Right.
Three of these wards. You know, and where the hell did they get the build those ships so fast? Well, of course, they already had ships. You know, I mean, they were shipping Africans from Africa for two centuries. You know, they had ships. They had shipping companies. They had everything. It's not like, you know, Portugal in Angola, where they never built anything and then tore what they built down before they left. The British didn't do that. They left. You know, they didn't. They came back and burned the capital in 1812.
Yes.
That didn't. And, you know, that didn't work.
And Jefferson's Navy blew up one of those ships in a suicide mission in the port in what we now call Libya. Suicide bombing was not new to the Middle East. The U.S. was doing it back then. We have just a couple of minutes left. How can we apply to the future this better understanding of the past? How can it help us with what the United States is now doing in Eastern Europe and Africa and Western Asia and Eastern Asia?
Well, I think we have to tie these together because, for one thing, the rest of the world, these people who are being attacked, they don't know this history either. They don't know why the hell the United States keeps doing these things. And I think it's like the king's new clothes. You know, once the veil is pulled, you know, or the voice is out there, this is the way it is, that I'm not sure what will happen, but I think it's one of those moments in time that in which, you know, simply a shift, it would be a paradigm shift, because it's not just the U.S. as, you know, settler state of Argentina or New Zealand or Australia. It's the most powerful country in human history, the most powerful military in human history, the most deadly machine. You know, it's moving into space. It's destroying the Earth. It's, you know, and it can't stop itself because, like Richard Slotkin has written a whole book called Regeneration Through Violence, where he tells all of this, too. You know, this story. But I think what he doesn't do and what has to be done is to name it colonialism, name it settler colonialism, and to understand, instead of this thing of binary, you know, white and black, and then everyone partly of color can be included in black, to talk about settler and the colonized.
We're now looking at much of the world as the colonized. We've been speaking with Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz. Among her books is An Indigenous People's History of the United States. Roxanne, thank you very, very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson.
I'm traveling around the United States right now doing events with my new book, War is a Lie, second edition. I hope to see you. Find the schedule of events at warisalie.org.
Take action at rootsaction.org.
Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org.
All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, countersnake.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, federal regulations work overtime to kill American prosperity. Well, you see what they did there. That's Reason Magazine on new Labor Department rules that mean more people will get overtime pay when they, well, work overtime. We'll get a different take from Ross Eisenbray of the Economic Policy Institute. Also on the show, hundreds of thousands of people around the world took to the streets last weekend in protest of Monsanto, the corporate giant that's one of the big six dominating the world's seed, pesticide, and biotechnology industries. Their anger had to do with much more than the labeling of GMO food. We'll hear about that from Patty Lovera of Food and Water Watch. That's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at the week's press. Presidential elections have a way of bringing to surface some core tenets of corporate media's conventional wisdom. One such pearl was expressed by David Shribman, a former New York Times political writer, now executive editor at the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, in a May 21st Times op-ed. It's about what Shribman calls Clintonism, the political creed that defined Bill Clinton's presidency. Quote, celebrated by its supporters as a synonym for peace, prosperity, and a common-sense centrism, Clintonism was and is still derided by its detractors on the left as corporatism and on the right as a shorthand for scandal and impeachable offenses, close quote. Say what you will is the upshot. Clintonism was an effort to pull the Democratic Party, which had lost five of the six presidential elections between 1968 and 1988, back into political relevance. And even though when he left office, many liberals felt bruised, quote, no one doubted that he had given new life to the party when he left office in 2001, close quote. It's hard to overstate how badly some people want to believe this idea, that by pulling the party to the right, Clinton, sure, threw some folks under the bus, but salvaged their prospects, if only they knew, by saving the Democratic Party. So it's worth looking back at actual events. Bill Clinton came into office with 258 Democratic House members, at the time a fairly typical number. The Democrats had controlled the House every Congress but two since 1931. Then came Clinton's triangulation, which, as Shribman tells, allowed him to pass, quote, major parts of his agenda, from a trade deal with Mexico and Canada to welfare reform to a crime bill, close quote. These constituency-losing moves led directly to the 1994 midterm massacre, in which the Democrats lost 52 seats and control of the House. Clinton came in with 57 Democratic senators and lost nine of those seats in the 94 midterms. Since then, the Senate has been mostly Republican-controlled. From the late 50s onward, Democrats had a big advantage in state houses that continued almost unbroken through the Nixon and Reagan eras. That ended in 1994. Since then, party control of state legislatures has on balance favored Republicans. So in real terms, Clintonism has been a disaster for Democrats. But those ideas, reducing aid to the poor, favoring corporate prerogatives, are just too appealing to some media elites for them to face that fact. The New York Times editorial board took time to sniff at a growing movement against Brooklyn District Attorney Kenneth Thompson, who's being criticized for recommending and getting a no-jail sentence for the police officer who killed Akai Gurley in 2014. Gurley was shot in a public housing stairwell and left to bleed to death in the arms of a friend. His death became a rallying point for those angry about the over-policing of communities of color, and that didn't abate when his killer, rookie Peter Lang, who didn't come to Gurley's aid, was indicted and eventually fired but avoided jail time, thanks in large part to Ken Thompson. in critics of Brooklyn DA miss the big picture, as Josmar Trujillo explains on fair.org, the New York Times explains that while it's fair and right to question how Mr. Thompson and prosecutors everywhere make their decisions, Thompson's overall record and reform efforts show a far greater awareness of the justice system's problems than many in his position. And therefore, quote, people who want a more just system should see him as an ally, close quote. Why readers should trust the Times for guidance to a more just system is anyone's guess, particularly when, as Trujillo notes, the sources of their intelligence appear somewhat limited. They don't note, for instance, that Gurley's own family is among the vocal band of critics they disparage, or the dozens of attorneys who staged a protest in front of Thompson's office. A related news article, May 16th's liberal Brooklyn prosecutor faces unlikely foes, liberal activists, didn't quote any black activists or black voices in a story touching on issues crucial to black lives. And finally, new poll finds 9 in 10 Native Americans aren't offended by Redskins' name, was the front page story in the Washington Post May 19th, based on a survey the paper conducted. Thing number one, the team's hometown paper had to say, quote, the results immediately celebrated by team owner Daniel Snyder and denounced by prominent Native American leaders could make it that much harder for anti-name activists to pressure Redskins officials who are already using the poll as further justification to retain the moniker, close quote. Well, it's naturally worth listening to a range of Native American people, but that happens so rarely in media that an instance like this merits some scrutiny. And for some, the word to describe these results would not be the one the Post chose, unambiguous. Jacqueline Keeler noted in The Nation that more than half of the poll respondents were over 50, when Native Americans have a median age of 26, or some 10 years younger than the general U.S. population. The Post says they weighted the results, but those were still the comments reflected in the piece. No respondents were under 18, and that might be justified methodologically. You need to follow certain protocols to interview minors. But it does leave a hole in the data's meaning, given that it leaves out the Native American students attending the 2,000 high schools in the U.S. that mascot Native Americans, and that the White House has reported face discrimination connected to that. The Post says, quote, it's entirely appropriate for a news organization to conduct a survey to test any assertions made about the breadth and depth of offense among Native Americans. This is customary for any other public policy issue, close quote. Well, that sounds reasonable, but the paper would have to have a record of actually regularly listening to those communities to make it sound convincing. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. It's no secret that those Americans who are working more hours for less pay than in decades and suffering for it. And while it's true, wealthy people may be finding new clandestine ways to tuck money away, some of the core causes of working people's problems are more out in the open, in the demonstrable erosion of worker wage protections. This, our next guest's group says, is a fixable problem. And one step in that direction came recently with the Labor Department's issuance of a new rule raising the salary threshold below which salaried workers are automatically eligible for overtime pay. Here to talk about the overtime rule, the pushback against it, and where it fits in broader efforts to fight inequality is Ross Eisenbray. He's vice president of the Economic Policy Institute. He joins us now by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Counterspin, Ross Eisenbray.
Thanks for having me, Janine.
Well, what was the purpose of overtime rules originally, and how have they been turned to that purpose or against it over the years up till now?
Well, they have the same purpose today that they had in 1938 when the federal law was enacted, which is to spread work so that instead of having two people working 60 hours a week, you could have three people working 40 hours a week. And employers have an incentive to work people long hours and to have fewer employees because there are all sorts of associated costs when you hire somebody. You're paying Social Security taxes and other taxes and so forth. So employers tend to prefer, many of them, to hire a few people and work them longer hours, especially if they don't have to pay for the longer hours. That actually becomes a huge incentive. So the Fair Labor Standards Act in 1938 said if you work somebody more than 40 hours, you'll have to pay time and a half, 150% of their regular rate for those additional hours. Employers have not liked this rule right from the beginning. They've lobbied against it, and it does apply to not just hourly workers, but salaried workers. This is something most people don't know, that if you're paid a weekly salary or an annual salary and you work more than 40 hours in a week, you can be entitled to overtime. There's one big exemption for professional, administrative, and executive employees, and that was in the law right from the beginning, but was left to the Department of Labor to explain, define, and delimit, as the law says. There are duties tests that show whether you are actually acting as an executive or a professional, and there's also a salary test. And the salary test, right from the beginning, said if you make less than this weekly amount, you can't be considered an executive and exempt, no matter what your duties are. So over time, of course, as the department revisits that regulation, they have to raise the salary level as overall salaries go up, and executive and professional salaries especially go up faster than the average. So they did that over time until the 70s, and then they kind of stopped doing it. And from 1975 until 2004, the salary level was not increased, and therefore the tests essentially lost meaning. And we went from having 12.9 million, I think, employees automatically covered, salaried workers automatically covered, to 3.5 million today. And that's when the Labor Department acted recently and restored most of the value of that salary threshold so that it now will cover about 16 million workers, which is a smaller percentage than back in the 70s, but gets us back to where most salaried workers can expect protection, can expect to be paid for their overtime.
The thinking behind that overtime pay was kind of to make sure that no one except really high-level employees who had some other benefits, they had control over their time and their tasks, so no one else besides them should be working overtime without being paid. Then there was also the idea that almost a kind of work-life balance, you know, that you have to be compensated if you're going to work more than 40 hours a week.
Yeah, there had been a 50 or 60-year movement led by the labor movement for an eight-hour day, and their slogan was 8 hours of work, 8 hours of rest, 8 hours for what you will. It was sort of the original work-life balance slogan and movement, and Congress finally responded to it only when we were in the middle of the Great Depression and 25% of the workforce was laid off, and it was a particularly compelling time to try to spread work. From a public policy point of view, it was crazy to have some people working 60 or 80 hours a week while other people were standing and soup lines.
That sounds a lot like today. I mean, we certainly would have a need or an impulse societally to spread work around at this time. Let's go now to the response. The coverage has taken the shape of really all these stories. There's an announcement of a rule, and then you get the Chamber of Commerce or some other employer representative who says this means the end of days. Can you address some of what is showing up as criticism? I'm reading that, for one thing, employers would raise wages to push people up to the limit where they don't have to pay them overtime. And that sounds like it's good because they're raising their wages, but ultimately it's going to be bad.
Well, that is clearly, in my view, a good thing. And I think every analyst agrees that one of the simplest responses for employers is to raise people over the threshold. And then all of the concerns that have been raised about, well, if I have to keep track of people's hours, it'll be a nuisance, it'll restrict their freedom. Those concerns go away because once you're above the threshold, they don't have to track your time or pay you for your overtime.
Right.
But then we have the National Retail Federation, which is one of the leading voices. They admit that employers will restrict hours for managers to whom they would otherwise have to now pay overtime and shift work onto mostly part-time workers. And they say it will create 117,000 jobs. But they say somehow, I don't understand this exactly, that that's a bad thing, that we're creating part-time jobs when we should be creating full-time jobs. But we wouldn't be creating any jobs,
right,
you know, if it weren't for the rule. We would just be overworking managers and not paying them for their time over 40 hours in a week. I don't buy that.
Yeah.
And then we have the universities who are putting on a fierce campaign up on the Hill, particularly in the Senate, saying if we have to pay our salary workers overtime, we'll have to raise tuition. And that's a terrible thing, and you, Congress, will be responsible for it if you don't stop this rule from going forward. And my answer to that is, out of all the people at the university, the ones whose salaries we're going to be concerned about are postdoctoral researchers who are now paid $43,000, $45,000 a year and are working 60 hours a week, you know, effectively about $15 an hour. We're worried about having to pay them overtime when we're paying football coaches $4 million, $7 million a year. We're paying university presidents $1 million to $3 million a year. You know, a whole slew of vice presidents and associate vice presidents, $200,000 to $300,000 a year. Come on. I find it really shameful.
It seems very clearly a question of priorities, and it would certainly help if it were more openly kind of discussed that way. But another aspect that I want to bring up is a quote that I read also from the National Retail Representative, probably the same person, but I found it interesting because he said, by executive fiat, the Department of Labor is effectively demoting millions of workers. Now, this has to do with the idea that workers are going to be redefined from salaried to hourly, and that's going to somehow demoralize them, even though they're, you know, getting paid more, which is a pretty quaint idea. But what's interesting to me is this idea that employers say the law does what in fact they do in response to the law. And reporters reported as though employers had no choice. You know, so they say, well, the Department of Labor is doing this. But in fact, employers always have a choice in terms of how they respond to a new regulation, don't they?
Yeah, that's a great point. There's nothing in this rule that says anyone has to be changed from a salary to an hourly basis, because you can keep track of hours of salaried employees. We do, and in fact, oddly enough, the National Retail Federation's own witness in congressional hearings, who was complaining about the rule before it was issued, said that she does keep track of the hours of her salaried employees. Mm-hmm. You know, when someone works 46 hours in a week, we keep track of that, and then we give them a day off, or we give them a bonus. We reward them for their hard work. But she was talking about salaried managers, the very people that the rule would affect. So you're absolutely right. There's nothing in the rule that requires a change. It's all within the discretion of the employer.
We've been speaking with Ross Eisenbray, Vice President of the Economic Policy Institute. You can find their work, including the Raising America's Pay Initiative, online at epi.org. Ross Eisenbray, thank you so much for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thank you so much for having me.
Anti-Monsanto rallies in 400 cities in 48 countries around the world failed to draw much U.S. media attention. Despite hundreds of thousands of people from Dhaka to Paris to Cape Town literally yelling out their opposition to the biotech giant's products and practices, and the disturbing impact of their increasing control over the food supply. But it's not that U.S. press don't care about Monsanto. A few days later, when word came that Bayer was in talks to buy it, that was big news. Few issues are more important than the food we eat. What would reporting that foregrounded the voices of farmers, indigenous communities, and consumers look like when it comes to a phenomenon like Monsanto? We're joined now by Patty Lovera. She's Assistant Director of Food and Water Watch. She joins us now by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Counterspin, Patty Lovera.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, I wouldn't want to imply that U.S. media have given no attention to controversies around Monsanto. They certainly have. I would say that a lot of that attention, especially lately, stays focused on GMOs, whether they're safe and whether they should be labeled. I have some issues with the way they cover even that. But my bigger concern is how it presents the story as one of relatively well-off U.S. consumers demanding to know every little thing that's in their food, you know, because they have too much free time, basically. But cotton farmers in India aren't killing themselves over labeling. What does Monsanto mean around the world that people in 400 cities would go out in the street?
Monsanto at this point has become synonymous, not just with GMOs, but I think also with a type of agriculture. And it's a type of agriculture that's really counter to the way a lot of people want to farm around the world and are still farming around the world. It's chemically intensive. I mean, Monsanto was a chemical company first, and then they acquired seed companies and engineered seeds through genetic engineering to make those crops work with their chemicals. So, you know, they sell Roundup and they sell Roundup ready corn and soybeans and cotton. So you can spray the crop with this weed killer Roundup. Before, it would have killed the crop, right? It would have killed the weeds, but it would have killed the crop too. Now, you know, the corn or the soy or the cotton is engineered to survive Roundup. That's a hell of a business model for a chemical company, and they sell these things together. And so it's really become a company that's kind of synonymous with that type of agriculture of very expensive inputs, expensive seeds and chemicals that go with them, and corporate control of these basic building blocks of the food supply.
Well, I want to pick up on one word, which is, you say, You can use these seeds. It's not as though Monsanto is saying, hey, we're in the market. We have a seed. You can choose our seed over other seeds. That's not the way it's playing out in terms of choice, is it really?
It depends on what part of the world you're talking about. But in the U.S., if you are growing kind of the commodity crops that we look at, you know, corn, soybeans, cotton, not wheat. They haven't figured wheat out yet. They haven't genetically engineered wheat, but the other big commodity crops, they have. And odds are, if you're growing those crops, you're probably growing a GMO, and you're probably growing a GMO that has a Monsanto patented trait in it. And it's hard for folks who don't want to do that type of agriculture here. It's hard for them to find options. In other countries, Monsanto has bought seed companies that used to be independent. There is that sense that it's hard to escape them and that they take over a lot of market share and that choice for farmers disappears. It's harder to avoid them. If it's not a company you want to support, you may not have other good options.
Monsanto actually sues farmers who try to save seeds or reuse seeds in the way that maybe their community has done for eons, you know. But once you kind of buy into Monsanto, you kind of have to stick with the company store.
Right. And that's one of the huge points of friction, especially outside the U.S. Historically, folks have held some seed back and saved it. You don't, you know, eat everything you grow or sell everything you're investing in next year. Hybrid seeds, which came before GMOs, changed this. They changed that business model. Big seed companies that then got, you know, bought by chemical companies like Monsanto or DuPont, you know, they were very big into hybrids, and they said they offered a lot of benefits in terms of better varieties and better yield, but it did stop a lot of seed saving. And GMOs take that to the next level because of the patenting that goes on. This is intellectual property that's in those seeds. And there have been very infamous examples of Monsanto going after people who did try to save seed and not pay that licensing fee the next year, and, you know, very high profile lawsuits and challenges. And that's a big disruption to the way people farm in many parts of the world. That's a really radical shift to the economics of farming.
It shifts the economics in which a place like India, which now has, you know, upwards of 90% of their cotton is GMO cotton that Monsanto is collecting these royalties, which are very, very high on. But it also has an impact on the planet, right? I mean, some of the concerns are about biodiversity.
Right. There's a choice issue we worry about when you have this much market share, when you have a couple of companies or one big company like Monsanto that's really controlling the majority of any one seed marketplace. There's also really a biodiversity issue, right? If you're making everybody farm, no matter where they are, with just a few varieties of something, you're taking diversity out of that system. And that is not a smart biological bet, you know,
right,
when you're growing something outside in places that have unpredictable weather or droughts or floods or pests or, you know, crazy things are happening with the climate. People's growing conditions are changing, and we're going to need more options to adapt to that around the world and make sure people have good options and a resilient food system, not less.
I resent in some way the way that media make it a story about, like, the proof of the danger of GMOs, you know, as though someone needs to eat a GMO tomato and drop dead, you know, when we're really actually talking about health on a bigger scale, on a community, on an environmental, and on ultimately a planetary scale.
Absolutely. And it's one of the most frustrating things working on this issue is the way that it gets portrayed. There's lots of folks who make some pretty extreme claims about what GMOs do.
Right.
And we don't have evidence to show that those are happening or not happening. And that's by design. We have a regulatory system that is designed to not look, to ask real questions about, are these the same as non-GMO foods? And we have a system that is incredibly good at and designed not to look at the chemical use that is absolutely tied to this model of production. I mean, GMO crops are tools of a chemical agriculture system, and it's been very separated in how we regulate things and approve things, and it really isn't getting counted as part of the public health impact of this type of agriculture. Europe does a better job than we do. There's still things they could do better, but when we get information about these chemicals, it usually comes from outside the U.S. because our system is not designed to look for it. So it absolutely should be part of the conversation, and instead we get caught in this very kind of reductionist look at it where they, you know, call you names and say you're like a climate denier if you dare to question this technology.
Sometimes I feel as though journalists think they're waiting for something to be settled before they weigh in, but we can already raise questions about the process. It's not as though we had a debate and people who think monopolies and corporate control of food and farmers not being able to control their seeds just convinced those people who didn't feel that way. You know, that's not how the process has worked, and it seems to me like maybe there's a role for journalists in there.
Yeah, absolutely. We had a really critical example of that just recently. The National Academies of Science put out a report every so many years. They kind of put out these big reports on these hot topics, and they put one out on GMOs. And, you know, a lot of people referred to the format as a sandwich. The opening part said, oh, we think they're probably fine. We think they're safe to eat. Then there was some bad news in the middle. That, oh, oops, they don't seem to increase yields. Doesn't seem like they actually help us produce more food. Oh, yeah, you know, we're seeing production problems because the weeds we keep spraying with Roundup are now resistant to Roundup, so we're going to have to switch to tougher herbicides. You know, like all the bad news is in the middle, and then they ended with, but they're probably safe to eat, so we think it's okay, and that was the headline. We actually went and looked at who was on this committee, and lots of them had some tie to this industry. This was not a neutral panel of experts. A lot of them had skin in this game, and that never makes that into the, you know, the coverage as well. It was a very convenient headline of, you know, expert panel says GMOs are safe to eat.
We've been speaking with Patty Lavera from Food and Water Watch. You can find their work on Monsanto and a range of other issues online at foodandwaterwatch.org. Patty Lavera, thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks for having me.
That's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio Eco Shop.
This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
This week I intended to explore the life of the founder of Peak Oil and then talk with the world's greatest expert on coral and dying coral. But climate change is disruptive. This past week, even higher record heat struck the lands known for record heat. The heat wave in both India and Pakistan is deadly and hardly reported by the Western media. Temperatures rose above 128 degrees Fahrenheit, or 51 degrees centigrade, in the shade. It's the hottest ever recorded in India. That was in the city of Falodi, in the desert state of Rajasthan, northwest India. 52 degrees C was expected in Larkana, Pakistan. In this part of the world, as in Australia, heat already kills more people than any other natural hazard. The greatest mass death event in Europe this century was the 2003 heat wave. This is the second year of extreme heat in Southeast Asia. As we'll hear from two scientific guests, all this was predicted by recent studies. The same studies say it will get even hotter for longer periods as the decades progress. Already the heat is breeding despair, suicide, violence, refugees, poverty, and hunger for hundreds of millions of people. It can also become a hotbed for terrorism. 2 points from our coming guests. The poorest victims of this heat are the least responsible for global warming. The source is half a world away, where most of us live in fossil-powered luxury. But in a world connected by finance, trade, and airplanes, the blowback can travel back half a world away from the steaming countries of India and Pakistan. Second, we used to believe that some climate catastrophe will finally drive the world to sanity, to change. Now we know each stage of tragedy becomes the new routine, the new normal, and stops being reported. We'll talk with Dr. Michael Wehner, who co-authored the report on extreme weather for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. He's got new research awaiting publication on the heat waves of India and Pakistan. I'll be sharing an email exchange with Indian scientist M. Rajivan. He's published research on the increasing frequency and severity of heat waves in India. Dr. Rajivan now heads the Climate and Meteorology Services for the Government of India. But first, I speak with one of Pakistan's leading intellectuals about the realities of punishing heat waves in a vacuum of public policy as his country struggles to survive our pollution. I'm Alex Smith. This week on Radio EcoShock, the news and science you need to hear about the hot new future.
Radio EcoShock.
The crushing heat in this year of 2016 is not the first to strike Pakistan and India. Just last year, thousands died, and Pakistan suffered a kind of heat paralysis. What happened then and now? Our guest is the dean of the Pardee School of Global Studies at Boston University. He's a professor of international relations concerning Earth and the environment. And Dr. Adil Najam was a vice chancellor at Lahore University of Management Sciences in Pakistan. Adil, a warm welcome to Radio EcoShock. Let's talk about last year's heat emergency. 1,000 people died in the heat of Karachi in 2015. Please describe that heat event for us.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for this conversation. Last year was a particularly bad year in terms of the impact of the heat. Now, Pakistan or South Asia is not a part of the world that is unfamiliar to heat, even to intense heat. This is the place where the highest recorded ever temperatures are routinely recorded. But one of the things that happened last year was that the intensity was more. The time period over which the heat wave persisted was more. This was true for South Asia in general, India and Pakistan in particular, and Karachi in Pakistan in particular. In Pakistan and Karachi's case, the perfect storm happened because this also came in the midst of the Muslim month of Ramadan, which is a month of fasting. And what that meant was that there were people who were fasting for religious reasons, who were trying to sort of push themselves harder. More than that, the infrastructure of support that is already missing in a poor country, especially for the poorest people, became even weaker. So all of these things combined to create this sort of massive wave and this number of, a very large number of people who died because of it. And it literally shook not just the large city of Karachi, but the country.
And just so we know, how many people live in Karachi?
Karachi is one of the largest cities in the world. You have certainly upwards of 10 million people living in this city. And I say that without precision because Pakistan has not had a census for a very long time. And the number of people who are kind of undocumented is even larger. So my own guess is we are talking about closer to 15 rather than 10 million people.
And is electricity for fans or air conditioning reliable in Karachi?
No, it is not. It is not reliable anywhere in Pakistan. But here is the thing. Anyone who can afford a air conditioner, which is very, very few people, and now I'm talking in single-digit percentages, can probably afford to run it because they'll also afford a generator of some sort. Anyone who can afford a fan, and that is not something that everyone would have, probably is still has some infrastructure to be able to survive and deal with this heat. The real issue is, and this is really the nub of climate change, that most people in a city like Karachi, but most people in this in the world, do not have the paraphernalia of dealing with these things that you and I might take for granted, right? We would take it for granted that, yes, you are poor, but that means you'll probably have a fan. Well, that's just not true for most people, not only in Karachi, but actually in the world.
And you have said half the deaths were preventable. What should national and state governments do to prepare for more heat events?
Well, I think all of the deaths are preventable. First of all, I am convinced that at least part of this, and we cannot say which part, is related to climate change. And if this is not, we would see more and more of that. And that means there's blood on your hands and mine. Right. So first, let's just start with that, that this is not just nature happening on its own. This is you and I and those of us particularly who are more affluent having outsourced our misery by our lack of action on climate change. But that may be a more deeper conversation. On an immediate level, I think that and many believe that these are preventable because this is not a country that is not used to heat. B, heat is something that you can deal with. It is a question of hydration. It's a question of not air conditioning as much as just getting water to people, making it easier for people to get a regular intake of water during the day. You know, things that we kind of take for granted and never talk about, a shade. Right now, you're talking about very poor people, mostly working outside in intense heat at a time when, because as I said, because of Ramadan, the infrastructure of dealing with that heat is low. Simply not having trees in a city, right? It's a very simple thing. But if you have ever walked anywhere in the sun, whether for pleasure or out of necessity, after a little while, if there is some place of shade where you can just sit and rest for a while, it makes a huge difference. And all of these things sound very, very small, but they are not, especially when they add up in a multi-million person metropolis. And that's why these are entirely preventable things. The tragedy is that we as a planet, and even Pakistan as a country, has the ability to deal with these things, and it is the negligence of our generation that these things keep happening. This time it was Karachi, but you also saw this in India. You see this with droughts in Africa and in Asia all the time. So there is a pattern to this. Here is my bottom line. People do not die because of heat. People die because of the inability to deal with that heat. And that means they die because of poverty, they die because of bad decisions, they die because of a lack of development.
That's so true. Well, it isn't just the heat. The 2010 floods in Pakistan were devastating. It must take years for the country to recover from such weather extremes, and I assume some farmers and families never do.
Some don't, but here is the sad thing about the flood. The 2010 floods, and we are now in 2016, never ended. What do I mean by that? We are now in the sixth consecutive year of floods. And now it doesn't even make the news. So there were multiple hundreds of people who died earlier this year in April in this year's flood. So every year since 2010, now the floods have kind of become this repetitive thing. And at least part of that is the melting of the glaciers up in the Himalayas, again, possibly with impact from climate change. And if you think about it, you know, I'm guessing your listeners are thinking, well, I didn't hear about them. That's because most people didn't hear about them. Even in Pakistani newspapers, it no longer makes news if 100 people die because of floods. And you kind of internalize this as if this is a new normal. Well, dying people should never be a normal. And it's not just the floods. We are also now in the fourth year of a drought in another part of Pakistan, in Thar, where children keep dying literally every day. And that also doesn't make news. And so this, to me, is the reality of a world with climate change. It is not simply the reality that there is more death and destruction and disaster. It is also the reality that you become immune to being moved by that death and destruction. It becomes a new normal, and we keep moving on as if, okay, this is how it was supposed to be. So if you look around the world at these climate-induced disasters, and you look at all of them together, you suddenly see, well, there's something happening. But we are also like that frog in boiling water, getting used to this as if, well, this is how it is. And that is a tragedy.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest Adil Najam. We're talking about Pakistan in the new age of global heat. Let's talk about Pakistan's energy sources. I'm just learning about that ice loss in the northern mountains of Pakistan, which you just mentioned. I presume that the many hydroelectric dams have enough water to run?
The politics of energy in Pakistan is pretty intense, as it is in many, many developing countries. Pakistan, back in the 60s, was at the forefront of building large hydroelectric dams. They were the motors of Pakistan's economic growth at that time. There were some mistakes also made. But since then, this kind of this political logjam on building new hydroelectric power, largely because of differences between different parts of Pakistan and the feeling that these benefit one part and not another. It's not an entirely unreasonable feeling, but that sort of kind of brought to a standstill the ability of the country to use hydroelectric to its potential. And also, I think there was a certain fascination with large dams as opposed to small and medium and even micro dams that could have benefited. So at this point, Pakistan is sort of has less energy and has a major energy crisis. And unfortunately, instead of looking at renewable sources, a lot of the emphasis and passion is being spent towards trying to build coal. And that, in my view, is not the best of solutions, but it is the direction that the country seems to be heading towards.
Yes, I was surprised to find out Pakistan has undeveloped coal reserves.
Pakistan does have undeveloped coal reserves. It is not the best quality coal in terms of cost and environmental features. But people like myself have also been arguing that even if you leave aside the environmental aspect, and in many cases, I can argue legitimately that countries like Pakistan, which use very little energy to begin with, which have very low carbon footprints of their own, their responsibility is different from large countries like the US or Europe that, or China or India, that have very large carbon footprints. But even if for a moment you leave aside the carbon question, coal to me is a dying technology. It is pretty clear that the writing on the wall is that we are moving away from the age of coal. So if you think about it, the largest coal company in the US recently went bankrupt. Weeks after that, the largest coal supplier in the world, a Chinese company, announced that they're going to move to begin trying to be a supplier of renewable energy. So this is not the best time to move into coal, just from an economic and investment point of view. And I've been sort of arguing, you know, it's like buying a six-track right when the iPod is being introduced. It is a technology whose time is gone, and we now have better technologies, partly because a lot of renewables are now cost competitive. Both solar and wind in various parts of the world, including in that region, have started coming cost competitive. And therefore, I hope not just Pakistan, but many developing countries will leapfrog. If there is going to be an energy revolution in the world, I don't think it will come from mature economies in Europe and the U.S. as much as emerging economies leapfrogging, you know, just skipping the dirty technology and leapfrogging to a cleaner technology, kind of like they did with cell phones.
Given the suffering of Pakistan from impossible floods to heat and drought, talk to us about the politics of climate change in Pakistan.
Unfortunately, there isn't much. Pakistan was mostly absent by its silence at Paris. But in my view, those who were speaking weren't making much sense either, but that's a separate issue. To the extent that there is climate change is an issue, unfortunately, Pakistan, like many other developing countries, has kind of wrapped itself in a shroud of victimhood. And it is not incorrect. It is correct. The victimhood is, we didn't create this problem. This is a problem that's been imposed on us by the excesses and the consumption of the developed world. Now, that happens to be true. But unfortunately, where I think it is wrong is that it leads to this thing, because we didn't cause it, we don't need to do anything about it. The reality of the science is that if you look at a world map of which countries and which areas are the most vulnerable, they are nearly all countries that have the least to do with creating the problem. So I can sulk in my victimhood, but that is not going to stop nature from throwing floods my way and heat my way and drought my way and glacial melt my way. And therefore, I think we are living now in what is the age of adaptation. And the front line of this, unfortunately, are the poorest countries, and within the poorest countries, the poorest communities. Now, that should again give a pause to you and me as, you know, the type of people who partly caused the mess. But it should also give us a moment to say, this is not simply about what we do with carbon. This is about how we do development. Because climate adaptation is a development issue. How do you deal with floods? Not by controlling energy. How do you deal with heat? How do you deal with drought? How do you deal with any of these disasters? You deal through better development. And I think that's where the solution is. And we need to start coming back to the place that climate essentially is a development challenge.
You know, at the gates of Europe, when we look at the makeup of refugees, some are from Pakistan. And I'm wondering whether it's just too hard to grow things there, too hot to stand living there, too hard to live there sometimes.
It could be, and I think there is a very legitimate concern about environmental refugees. And we've seen that happening certainly in Africa and possibly in South Asia, including in Pakistan. But here is, I mean, I don't want to throw a totally gloomy picture. There is a lot of good, there is not good news. There is a lot of potential that is positive also. So, for example, I led a study with some colleagues in Pakistan where we looked at what climate change impact on agriculture would be. This is mostly an agricultural country. And found that over 25 years, we found that for the two major crops, it could be up to 15% of yield. Now, that's a major thing if your economy is dependent on it. But here is the interesting thing. What we found was that with good adaptation practices, development, the yield could actually go up 60%.
60%?
60. 6-0.
Wow. Right?
And why is that? Because in Pakistan, as with many developing countries, there is a lot of room to grow into the better practices that they are not able to do because of lack of development, right? So either we treat climate change as a post-disaster reaction. We will wait for bad things to happen, and then we will, our humanity will arise, and we will send a little money so that we feel good about how we are helping the world. Or, as I've been arguing, we treat it as a development challenge, and before the bad things happen, we invest in development, and particularly what I was talking about, leapfrogging. So agriculture is one of those things. If you look at agriculture in developing countries, including Pakistan, there is a lot of room for good practices that would not only lessen the impact of climate change, but could actually allow countries to produce more. So I have always argued that the race here is between human knowledge and human wisdom. We have no dearth of knowledge on how to solve these problems. The challenge is that we have not demonstrated the wisdom or the will to deal with things that we are perfectly capable of dealing with.
Well, I think to do that, we'd have to escape something in our character that looks first at our own personal greed and very last at people on the other side of the world.
Exactly, exactly. And we have to realize that and this is where we may not yet be a fully evolved species. The assumption that what is good for me is only what happens in my immediate environment, you know, neighborhood, is just a patently false assumption. And that is why I get very concerned when anything first comes up, because it assumes immediately that everything else must be second. So to assume that someone on the other side of the world has no bearing on what happens to me, or should have no bearing, is not just morally wrong, it is intellectually bankrupt. And that we should have realized in realizing that the planet is interconnected. So just like Pakistan's floods or heat has to do with, may have as much to do with emissions, you know, half a world away, remember that what happens half a world away will impact us tomorrow. Maybe it impacts us, as you said, on those gates of Europe or tomorrow in the U.S., of people who leave their home and say, okay, if I can't live there, I'm coming where you are. But unless we start realizing that this is one planet, it's a fairly small planet, and we haven't done a good job with it, we are going to be in trouble.
What is the Pardee School of Global Studies?
The Pardee School of Global Studies is a school of international affairs. Boston University created the school 2 years ago by bringing together its various institutes and departments that work on international affairs. We have a global focus on global issues and on international issues. So at one level, it is like any other school of international affairs. We study international relations, we study war, we study peace, we study economic development, terrorism. But we do have a particular focus on the global aspects and this realization that for the first time in human history, there are a whole bunch of processes that are not just international between countries, but global in how they operate. Environment and climate is obviously one of them, but international finance is another. International migration is another. So international information is another. And so the school is trying to build a school of international and global affairs that responds to the 21st century challenges that we are faced with.
So Pakistan is the sixth most populous country in the world. We should be watching it. If we want to be Pakistan watchers, what should we look for?
I think we should look for what is happening to ordinary people in Pakistan, like you are right now with the heat wave. Unfortunately, we look at too much. We should also look at that, but we look at it too much from the perspective of international security and terrorism. And this, again, is one of those areas where issues get connected. I do not think these are unrelated issues. If you have large populations of people who are uncomfortable, whose economic opportunities are limited, who are made even more limited by climate change, they are going to make decisions that will not be rational. So what we should be looking for is what happens to ordinary people. And this is not just for Pakistan. I think that is true everywhere. And I'll go back to what I said earlier. The tragedy is not that we have massive challenges. The tragedy is that we actually have the ability to solve them, and we keep abdicating that responsibility. Floods are one, but let me give you an easier example, food. There is no reason in the world for at least a quarter century now that anyone should die hungry anywhere. Right? Just from a mathematical sort of statistical point of view, there is enough food to feed everyone. And yet we know that people die hungry all across the world, even in the most affluent societies. That is not a failure of agriculture. That's not a failure of food. That is a failure of our institutions globally. And you can apply that principle to a whole number of things, including on Pakistan. But, you know, it's Pakistan today. It's Afghanistan tomorrow. It's going to be Africa day after tomorrow. But we, unless we develop the capacity to think of ourselves as citizens of the globe, we are going to be in trouble. That doesn't mean we become less of a citizen of a Pakistan or a U.S. or a Canada. But that does mean that we have to understand that we have the shared home and we have the ability to make it a better place.
You know, I'm concerned that we'll see continuous blows from climate disruption and it may lead to more failed states in different parts of the world. Are you optimistic or pessimistic about how it's going to go for Pakistan?
I suspect you are right, but for me, pessimism is not a choice. I don't know if I'm optimistic, but you have to keep trying, right? If you become pessimistic and give up, then whatever little good that could happen will not happen. But I suspect that you are right, at least in part. I used to believe years ago, I spent too much of my life working on these issues years ago, I used to believe that maybe we will need some very great tragedy for the world to be shaken into action, that something really bad will happen and then we will act. Unfortunately, I and you have now lived to too many of those great tragedies, whether they are events like 9/11, whether they are floods like 2010, whether they are earthquakes in Nepal. We just keep getting tragedy after tragedy, and the unfortunate reality is that it has not shaken us up. In a way, it has routinized tragedies of a level that should not be routinized. You know, there's a rhythm to this. Something really bad happens, it gets plastered all over CNN, Twitter erupts in this great wave of empathy, and 2 days later, it's the next episode of the Kardashians or whatever, and we move on. And in some ways, our ability to show our empathy in 140 characters has made it easier for us to think, okay, my job is done. I wrote that tweet about how much I care about people dying this place or that. Now I can move on. And so part of me is a pessimist in that way. On the other hand, the possibility of our ability to do something keeps driving me to say we cannot give up.
Yes, a pessimist who won't give up. I think that's me as well. We've just heard from one of Pakistan's leading intellectuals. Dr. Adil Najam is an internationally recognized expert on international affairs. He's published widely and once hosted himself a public affairs program on Pakistan television. These days, he's at Boston University as the dean of the Pardee School of Global Studies. You can find links to all of this in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Adil Najam, thank you. It's been a pleasure to have you on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. In this next interview, be patient and you will be rewarded. Some listeners I know will be frustrated by the language of scientific caution at the start from our guest, Michael Wehner. But hang in. That caution makes his disturbing predictions all the more serious. When the atmosphere is loaded with extra warming gases, extreme weather appears all over the world. The latest outbreak is a giant combination of heat and drought over most of India and neighboring Pakistan. When the thermometer goes over 120 degrees Fahrenheit or 49 Celsius, it's deadly. Is this Indian heat emergency just natural variability, El Nino, or a preview of an unstable warming world? Here to help is Dr. Michael Wehner. He's a staff scientist at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. Dr. Wehner specializes in extreme weather events from rainfall to heat waves. He's published on the heat wave in Pakistan 2015, and he's watching this year's relentless heat in India as another case. Michael Wehner, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you for having me.
What is your first take on this record-breaking heat wave that enveloped India in the spring of 2016?
Well, it's surprising because last year was also record-breaking in many ways in India, and the consequences on human health and well-being can be quite severe, and my sympathies go out to the people that are affected. And from a scientific point of view, these kinds of heat waves are very interesting. Of course, it's always been the case that there have been both heat waves and cold snaps that arise out of the natural variations in the climate system that we call weather. What we have learned recently is that we can actually determine in some probabilistic manner the effect that the human interference in the climate system has had on extreme weather events, if there is one. Sometimes there's not. But heat waves, in general, have some sort of detectable and attributable contribution. And, of course, this heat wave just having occurred, it's a little difficult to say that with any authority. But it has been our experience that every major heat wave in the last several years that has been studied has shown some human influence. And by the human influence, I mean it is either more likely to have occurred and reached the temperatures that were actually measured, or conversely, if you consider an event of a fixed rarity, it's a little bit hotter.
You know, Western media have done a lousy job covering this heat emergency in India, and it's embarrassing to ask, but why should my listeners in North America or Europe care about it?
Well, I think we should care, if for no other reason, the human tragedy. But I think it's not a wake-up call for me. I mean, maybe it should be a wake-up call for some that global warming has an effect that is, like I said, detectable and attributable right now. So this is not something that's occurring in the distant future. You know, maybe a lot of what the people have read are about things that are going to happen 100 years from now. And in fact, you know, I've written a lot of that. But, you know, this is something that's here and now. And it's not just in India. The Texas heat wave in 2011 was shown to have the chances of reaching that level of severity were doubled by human changes to the composition of the atmosphere. Similarly, in Europe in 2003 and again in 2012 and again last year, the human influence was shown to be even greater than that in the most recent ones. And this is true all over the world, that in general, heat waves have become a little bit more severe because of the global warming.
And these things can have geopolitical impacts. I'm thinking of the Russian heat wave in 2010, where the harvest was gone bad and they had to limit exports. And one of the world's biggest importers of wheat, Egypt, went into unrest, the Arab Spring. What do you think about the geopolitical impacts of these things?
Oh, I don't think that in a global economy, and then particularly in a global agribusiness economy, there are long, what we would call in meteorology, teleconnections, you know, long distance effects from something happening in one part of the world. And the food economy is so interconnected that a crop failure in one part of the country, in one part of the world, can cause undue stress in other parts, and particularly in poor developing nations where the fraction of income that anybody earns that is spent on food is much larger than in the fully developed nations. You know, this connection between crop failures in one part of the world and political unrest in another is an interesting one. It's quite plausible. As a physical climate scientist, I realize how difficult it is to make a quantitative statement about such things.
Do you see a developing relationship between climate-driven weather extremes and the refugee crisis?
Well, this is something I also, again, would believe is quite plausible, but again, a difficult thing to show causality on. But I think in many ways we've only seen the tip of this problem, this iceberg of a problem. The amount of climate change we've had since the pre-industrial age is about 0.85 degrees centigrade. Now, in any plausible future scenario, 2 degrees of warming is almost virtually certain. You know, this is the target that the Paris meeting, the Conference of Parties, the COP21 it was called, agreed to, and they wanted to further limit to 1.5 degrees. But these targets are so difficult to meet that there will have to be substantial reductions in the consumption of fossil fuels across the world, not just in the United States, although the United States would have to seriously move towards a carbon-free economy. I actually am very pessimistic that these targets would be met. Rather, you know, the most plausible ones that I believe are the so-called business-as-usual scenarios, which by 2100 lead to somewhere between 3.5 and 6 degrees warming. Now, these are planets that we have no experience with, and it is highly unlikely that there wouldn't be dramatic social upheavals. And so, you know, you can be as pessimistic as you like on this, but, you know, the best case scenario is that there's twice as much warming as we have already experienced. And we are already seeing impacts on people's well-being.
And you published on these different pathways in the journal Climatic Change with Claudia Tibaldi. The title is Benefits of Mitigation for Future Heat Extremes under RCP 4.5 compared to RCP 8.5, and that's sort of a middle path and the worst-case path. What did you find in that paper?
Well, first of all, I wouldn't call the difference between a worst-case path and a middle path. It was the difference between a rather dramatic reduction in carbon fuel consumption and the worst case that we considered. Now, you have to understand that the worst case we considered, and this was something that was developed for the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, fifth assessment report, which Claudia and I actually were both lead authors on. These scenarios of a future climate were constructed back around 2005. And so we know where we are relative to that worst case scenario. And in fact, the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is actually higher than what we thought was the worst case scenario just 10 years ago. So that being said, what we found is that doing this rather dramatic reduction did have tangible benefits to reducing the future increased frequency of heat waves. And what I mean by that is that even in this dramatic reduction of carbon dioxide emissions into the atmosphere, the changes to the frequency and magnitude of heat waves is profound, but it's not as bad as if we don't do anything at all. And so the title was chosen to be positive, and we can credit Claudia for that. She's a very positive person. There is a very real benefit that would translate to social benefits to the rather large investments that would be required to change our consumption, our patterns of consumption of carbon dioxide. But I think it's important to remember that we're not off the hook.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Dr. Michael Wehner from the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory in California. We're talking about killer heat waves and climate change. All right. Now, in 2015, there was a similar massive heat wave in Pakistan, and at least 1,000 people died in Karachi alone. You published a paper on this. I'm not familiar with this. What was the title of that paper?
Well, actually, that paper is in review right now. So we'll see how it goes. And off the top of my head, I don't remember the title. I think it's called The Deadly Heat Waves in Pakistan and India in 2015, or words to that effect. The interesting question when we started that work was there were deadly heat waves in both India and Pakistan. They were separated by about 5 weeks. And so the first question was, how are these two heat waves related? And I honestly didn't know when we started. And what the answer was is that they're not actually related. The heat wave in India was due to a delay in the onset of the monsoon. What sometimes happens when the monsoon is delayed is that winds come from Pakistan and overland into central and eastern India, and they're hot and dry. And that was the cause of the 2015 Indian heat wave. in Pakistan, by the time the Pakistani heat wave had happened, which was late June, early July, in India the monsoon had fully developed. And so it rained, it was cooler. And in fact, especially in Karachi, which is the weather station that we use for this analysis, the winds had changed so that in Pakistan they were coming off the ocean, but it was still hot. And so it was hot and humid in Karachi. So in India, up until this year, actually, it was the hottest in some places that had ever been observed, but it was also dry. In Karachi, the temperatures were not the record temperatures, but the combination of heat and humidity were indeed records, as best as we can tell from the observations we have. In the heat waves, the combination of high heat and high humidity is especially deadly.
And critics say some of those deaths in Pakistan in 2015 were preventable. What can governments or NGOs in developing countries do to help their populations survive extreme heat?
Well, this is a really, really good question, and one that is close to our present and future research. And this is what we found, especially in Pakistan, is that there wasn't enough warning for people to prepare. And then when the heat wave did really come into full swing, services, public health services, were overwhelmed. They were coming into hospitals at a rate greater than they could be treated or admitted, in fact. So what could NGOs do? They could help in two ways. One is in developments of early warning systems. These heat waves can be predicted several days at least in advance, if not a week or so. And so preparations could be made. But more in the long-term sense, infrastructural improvements are needed, especially in developing nations. But I should add this could happen anywhere. In the Paris heat wave of 2003, many tens of thousands of people died because of that event. And part of that was because of social practices. And so, you know, what can be done in the United States and the developed nations? And this is interesting. Some cities, especially Philadelphia, have plans in place to check on the vulnerable. Now, who are the vulnerable in a heat wave? Well, oftentimes it's the very old, the very young, of course, too. But it's the very old and the poor. So systems that make sure that that these people are okay, you know, can really go a long ways to reducing the death toll.
So if the world continues to depend mainly on fossil fuels well past 2050, and that's what it looks like right now, how hot can it get?
Oh, this is the big question. Like I said, by the middle of the century, we should expect a minimum of at least another degree centigrade, which is about 2 degrees Fahrenheit, warming over now. And that's pretty much independent of what future scenario of greenhouse gas emissions we take. And that's one of the things about climate change, is that there's no immediate gratification to a change in the patterns of consumption of fossil fuels, because the climate system reacts relatively slowly. And so if we act now, we shouldn't expect too much of a change in the variety of things that could happen by the middle of the century. Where we would see that is like 2075 and afterwards. This is one of the things that makes climate change a difficult political issue, is that in order to realize any actual benefits, one has to take the actions long in advance of those benefits being realized.
Yes, the Save the Next Century movement isn't that strong.
You have to have an overriding concern for the welfare of your grandchildren and others, and other people's grandchildren as well, I should add.
What climate research interests you the most these days?
What I think is the most interesting area is the intersection of physical climate scientists like myself with social scientists. That is the most exciting thing that I'm involved in. And the reason it's exciting is because the conversation has only really begun to happen. My principal colleague is Federico Castillo at the University of California, Berkeley, and he's from Costa Rica. And when I teach in his class, I tell them that the big challenge we have is the language difference, and I'm not talking about the Spanish-English thing. And everybody laughs, because what I'm really referring to is the difference between talking to an economist and a climate scientist. We have different ways of looking at the world and different ways of doing our science, and bridging that gap is challenging but really interesting.
We'll have to leave it there. We've been speaking with climate and weather expert Dr. Michael Weiner. He is a senior staff scientist at the Computational Research Division at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory in California. He studies and publishes new science about the relationships between climate disruption and extreme weather events. And I'll put some links to all of that in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Well, Michael, thank you so much for helping us on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
To complete this Radio EcoShock feature on the heat emergencies in India and Pakistan, I wanted to get you a more official position directly from India, and I found exactly the right person. While working for the Indian Institute of Tropical Meteorology, Dr. M. Rajivan just published on May 19, 2016, a paper in the journal Nature. The title is spot on. It's On the Variability and Increasing Trends of Heat Waves Over India. Already, Dr. Rajivan has moved on to become the secretary to the government of India in the Ministry of Earth Sciences. As M. Rajivan was traveling, I was unable to reach him by telephone for this program. However, he sends us, by email, answers to my questions. This may be a bit strange, but I'm going to read you my short questions and his replies. First question, please tell us your role for the government of India. The reply, I am the head of the Ministry of Earth Sciences, which has the mandate of providing weather, climate, ocean, and seismological services in the country. Second question, why did you and your team undertake this research into heat waves? His reply, I am basically a researcher working on climate variability and monsoon prediction. Heat waves was one of my favorite topics of research, as it has social relevance. Last year, almost 2,500 people died due to heat waves. This year, another 500 people approximately, as per the news reports. My PhD student, Ms. Rohini, does this work with me. Then I asked, when did you begin this research and what are the main methods you used? This answer from Dr. Rajivan. It started almost 9 months back as part of her PhD thesis work. This work is mainly a data analysis using advanced statistical methods. The objective of the work was to identify whether there are trends in heat waves over India and what are the large-scale climate forcing for the variability of heat waves. I asked, did it surprise you when a major heat wave struck just a month after your paper was published? He writes, it was not a surprise. It was expected. In fact, this year we have started issuing a seasonal outlook on heat waves and informed people that this year we should expect above normal temperatures in the country with very high probability of severe heat waves in the country. That initiative was based on our results and understanding. We used a state-of-the-art climate model to generate probabilities of heat waves over India. I asked, how does this heat wave compare with those in the past? He replies, this year's heat wave is one of the worst. We had several days of extreme temperatures. Many temperature records were surpassed. At one station in West Rajasthan, Falodi, daytime temperatures touched 51 degrees centigrade. I asked him, what are the major findings of your paper? His reply, our findings are, heat wave frequency, duration, and maximum length of heat wave events are increasing over the country, especially over central and northwest India. Total duration of heat waves has shown an increase of 1.3 days per decade and maximum duration 0.76 days per decade. Then we also analyzed major climate forcings that act on the variability of heat waves. We find that both the equatorial Pacific Ocean, El Niño events, and the equatorial Indian Ocean are responsible for the variability and trends of heat waves over India. We find that heat waves are not a regional phenomenon, but caused by planetary-scale forcings, with the projections that major El Niño events increasing and the Indian Ocean warming anomalously, we can expect that frequency, duration, and maximum length of heat waves will show further increase in the future. I wonder, does India have a reliable way of reporting heat-related deaths? Dr. Rajivan says, we have some reports getting on heat-related deaths, but we do not have a decent way of recording deaths that occur due to weather anomalies, like heat waves. My next question. We have news reports that hundreds of farmers in India have committed suicide due to heat or crop failure. Is it true? He said, there are news reports, but I am not sure about that. I cannot comment. I then asked, in India, are these kind of heat emergencies generally accompanied by drought? The reply, yes, to some extent. Last 2 years, droughts have caused soil moisture to deplete. Dry soil is one of the feedback processes to enhance the severity of heat waves. Therefore, droughts and heat waves could be linked. Next question. Does record-setting heat reduce the expectation of agricultural production in the year? His reply, heat waves do generally occur before the monsoon season starts. However, heat waves do not affect the ensuing monsoon season performance. I said, up to 600 million people in India do not have electricity. How do they cope when temperatures go above 120 degrees Fahrenheit? Dr. Rajivan simply said, good question. My next question, if the carbon dioxide levels continue to escalate, and global mean temperatures rise above 2 degrees centigrade, what will that mean for India? This reply from Rajivan, this is really a concern. What the climate models project for the country are increasing heat waves and increasing frequency of heavy rainfall events. Therefore, we have to develop a strategy to meet the challenges and mitigation. Our government is seriously planning some measures towards this. My next question is about the role of governments. What can national and local governments do to prepare themselves and the population? He replies, there should be involvement from both local governments and national policies. There are some social issues also in our country. Many farmers and laborers work on outfields during daytime. Any type of warnings may not discourage them to go outfield for their work. They have to work and get their salary. In my last question, is there anything else you would like to leave with our listeners around the world? This reply from Dr. Rajivan, we have started prepared city-based heat wave action plans in which local governments and health departments work together with our ministry officials. That concludes our email interview. I appreciate Dr. Rajivan taking the time while he travels with his key role advising the government of India. He will be very busy both with his current record-setting heat wave and his research into the prediction of monsoons, and that will eventually rescue India from the heat when the rains come. I'll put links to the full text of the new paper by M. Rajivan in my show blog, published every Wednesday at ecoshock.info. The paper by M. Rajivan and his co-authors finds that for each decade studied, in India, one more extra extreme event happened. Each decade, the heat wave lasts 2 days longer than the previous decade, and those extra days can be the most deadly for people, animals, and crops. Their study shows these great heat waves will only get more frequent and stronger as we move through this century. Greater tragedies and more suffering are already dealt in the carbon card game. We know from other science that's not just for India. This is the future for Paris, for Moscow, for the American South, for the Arctic, for Brazil, Africa, everywhere. As we've heard, this unbearable heat is accompanied by drought. Tens of thousands of farmers in India have fled their burned-out fields to live in city shanty towns. Reuters reports hundreds of farmers there have killed themselves instead. With water shortages come the usual killer diseases. Nobody knows how many have died from this heat emergency in India or Pakistan. The grave diggers of Karachi are taking no chances. They have prepared an extra large trench for mass burials. But who are the grave diggers of Karachi? We are. Here's the big picture from the science by our guest Michael Wehner and his co-author Claudia Tibaldi. I'll quote from a press release about their study. Sweltering heat waves that typically strike once every 20 years could become yearly events across 60% of the Earth's land surface by 2075 if human-produced greenhouse gas emissions continue unchecked. End quote. This press release from the University Corporation for Atmospheric Research continues, if emissions remain unabated, a heat wave with a 1 in 20 chance of occurring in 2050 would be at least 3 degrees Celsius, that's 5.4 degrees Fahrenheit, hotter for 60% of the world's land areas. For 10% of the land areas, a 20-year heat wave in 2050 would be at least 5 degrees C or 9 degrees Fahrenheit hotter. We are talking about a different planet, people, than the one you grew up on. So why don't those Indian or Pakistani people just stay home, turn on the fan, or go down in the cooler basement? Many don't have a home, much less a basement. Millions, likely hundreds of millions, cannot afford a fan or find the electricity to run one. And if you don't go to work in the hot, hot day of the fields, your family doesn't get any food either. Those who can leave will leave. They will come to where it's cooler, to places where there are fans and electricity. They will come however they can. Others, as Adil Najam says, will make irrational choices and decide to kill the affluent people they perceive to be killing them. It's all connected now, in nature and in the human economy. What happens on the other side of the world matters. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for joining us this week on Radio EcoShock. As we leave, I'd like to play my small tribute to another strong voice who left us last week. Michael Marriott headed the Nuclear Information and Research Service in Washington, D.C. since 1985. He helped turn the tide away from the madness of nuclear power in the United States. Here you go, Michael. Here's my song for you.
Still committed
to the very last day.
To the truth.
Michael Marriott.
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 In the 1990s alone, a number of nuclear plants have closed. Four in New England, for example, Yankee Row, Millstone 1, Maine Yankee, Connecticut Yankee. We've had two reactors close in Illinois, the Zion reactors. We've had Trojan close in Oregon. Rancho Seco in California closed in 1989. San Onofre in California closed in the 90s. In 1974, then-President Richard Nixon said there would be 1,000 nuclear reactors operational in the United States by the year 2000. Today, we will have less than 100.
The narrator, would you say he's the most normal member of his family?
I guess he's kind of the classic observer in the family, that he's surrounded by people that have more personality and more skills and more, you know, just bigger than life characters. And I've kind of always identified with the person who's observing and is actually the one who can chronicle what's actually taken place in time. And I kind of played that role in my family to some degree. I've got I'm the only one, in my opinion, who can be trusted for a historical account of my family whatsoever.
Give me a quick rundown of who the family members are and what's crazy about them.
Well, the grandfather is perhaps most like the narrator in that he's a sane guy who designs and builds sailboats and has a love for the boats and has a love for keeping the family together and just likes to. He likes to build boats for common people. You know, he's not crazy about the way that it's become a sport for the super rich. The father is a Olympic medalist in sailing and is a hard driving. You know, sailing is the bar by which the whole family is living all the time, and he's constantly trying to improve the family business by being more competitive on the water. Drills the kids with all the sailing info growing up. The mother, she is a scientist, she's a physics teacher, and she's obsessed in her own way, but not so much about sailing, but as going about trying to understand the world either through astronomy or physics or whatever, and has an intensity about her, obviously, in trying to solve unsolvable math problems. And then the three kids, you got Bernard, the oldest one, who is just a rebel at heart and can't wait to rebel against the domineering father and get as far away from him as he can. And then you have Ruby, the one who all the sailing wisdom and gifts and whatever that has been distilled through this family shows up in her, and she turns her back on it, which kind of helps trigger the splitting of the family, all of which is narrated by Josh, going back and forth in time, the milder middle child who just wants to fix boats and help people and pull things back together.
He doesn't want to just fix boats. He also kind of wants to fix his family.
Yes, correct. He wants to fix his family. He's trying to find love online, and he's trying to do a lot.
Ruby, I've only met a few people like this in my life, but you don't forget them. Kind of ethereal.
Yeah, that's exactly the kind of person I was trying to capture with her. And, you know, people that just kind of seem to, you know, walk lightly on the earth, and could do things that weren't quite explainable. You know, that they just somehow seem to stretch reality. And a lot of those people don't seem to, you know, stay alive all that long. You know, it's almost like they're short for their time here. And I was after all that, as well as kind of the child prodigy. We usually focus on their math or their music skills, but you know, why not a sailor? Why not just this remarkably intuitive sailor who could figure out where the wind was going better than everybody else?
Yeah, she's just. I mean, she can just. I mean, the rest of the family is looking at waves and trying to figure it. She just knows.
Well, and I've sailed with people that are just a league above, you know, a couple leagues above what I can sail well, but I can't anticipate the pattern of wind shifts and know which side of the course to be on or where to be to catch the next gust. And if you get them to try to explain it, they really can't. It's much more of an intuitive thing.
Poor Josh gets a message from his father saying, I'm bringing you a boat. You are going to make the boat ready, and we as a family are going to win a race.
Yeah.
Considering they're barely even speaking to each other.
Right, yeah.
I mean, all of them are, I mean, they're right. All...
Scattered.
Yeah.
That's the assignment from the first chapter on, that Josh has to transform this old family boat that they designed and make it competitive against modern sailboats, which is kind of an impossible task and also unethical if they don't report the changes to the boat to the race officials, because these are all handicap races, all of which is weighing on Josh. But at the same time, he does see this possibility that the entire family could get together for a reunion race on the boat. And so that's a strong motivator.
It's both a really good idea and one of the worst ideas ever.
I liked having I liked having them in a compact space like that. All their differences, all their realizations, all their secrets, it was going to come spilling out. If it was going to come spilling out, that was the perfect place for it. At least so I felt. And then combining that energy and that momentum with the ebb and flow of a race with wildly fluctuating wind speeds was all kind of thrilling to write. I was so looking forward to getting to that chapter in my mind, you know, to actually write that scene. It was all kind of exhilarating right there, at least for me.
The book is dedicated to your father. So the question I have to ask is, did Dad like it?
Dad is coming up on 90 years old, and he's read it, I think, 3 or 4 times now. And
wow.
he's a big reader, and his recall isn't as strong as it was, but he still picks up more every read through, and he sees the bits and pieces from my youth and so on. He sees himself in there in glimpses, but he's enjoyed it. My sister's fully embraced it. And
does your family still get together periodically and go out and have a family sail with your dad?
Definitely. So when my dad turns 90, we're going to take him sailing on that day. My wife and daughter and sister will be out there. So, yeah.
Wow, that'll be a blast.
Yeah, it should be.
The book is Before the Wind, a novel. I've been speaking with the author, Jim Lynch, and Before the Wind, published by Broad Street Books.
Final award for the evening is for a Palestinian community organizer from the south side of Chicago. She especially organizes with young Arab, Black, and Latino youth on the south side. She organizes from the very center where her family organized on Palestinian issues in the 70s and 80s. She's a lead member of the Rasmia Defense Committee and a lead member of USPCN National. She is currently working with her youth on their three-year campaign to end racial profiling by law enforcement. Everyone give it up for Nesreen.
Hi, everyone. I'm usually here speaking about my work around, you know, the Arab American Network or the United States Palestinian Community Network. And those both of those places, I'm very honored. And I'm very, very humbled, and I'm very, very, like, I'm blushing. I'm, like, red like a tomato right now because I am just so honored to be awarded by the people I love and people who do such amazing work. But I would not be here today without the help of two women in my life. And I can't, and thank God it's International Women's Day, right? Because this gives me the opportunity to thank them. So I'm not going to make this award about me. I'm going to make it about the women who shaped my life. One of those women is the very woman we're honoring tonight, which is Rasmia Ouda. You know, I'm going to keep it short. I don't want to take too much time because we have a program to go through. But I actually met Rasmia in the year 2008. At our school, Governor State, which is actually also going through a budget crisis as well. We were both criminology majors, and we developed a friendship around that time. And then in the year 2011, another woman who shaped my life passed away that year, which was my teta, my grandma. She passed away. And I met Rasmia again, and I'm like, Rasmia, what are you doing here? My aunt grabs me, and she said, you don't call her Rasmia, you call her Auntie Rasmia. And Rasmia was like, don't worry, I'm 19, I'm younger than you. You don't have to call me Auntie Rasmia. And I looked at my aunt, I'm like, uh-huh. So, you know, my family were organizers back in the 70s and 80s around Palestine. My aunt was a student at UIC back in the day. My grandpa is one of the founders of the Arab Community Center in the early 70s. But as you all know, and especially the Palestinians in the room all know, there was a hiatus after Oslo. Palestinian organizing went down, and so did my family. My family stepped back because they were so heartbroken about the events of Oslo. But during my college years, while I was with Rasmia, I organized around the abolishment of the death penalty in the state of Illinois, which passed. And I worked on the south side of Chicago with the working poor. But I really wanted to work with my community and organize in my community. And if it wasn't for Rasmia, I wouldn't be standing here today and call myself an organizer. I owe her everything, and I love you. I, as an organizer, when I first started, I was terrified to work with the Palestinian community, even though I was passionate. I am I'm a Palestinian American, and my Arabic is horrible when I first started. And it was Rasmia who told me Palestinians in the diaspora play a crucial part in liberating the Palestinian people as well. So that gave me inspiration. And Rasmia doesn't only inspire all young women in our community. She helps all of us connect. And she helped me build relationships with people that I will forever cherish in my life. We all know Rasmia is the strong, defiant, independent woman. But I also know the side of Rasmia that is sweet and kind and very optimistic. One of the many things that I admire about Rasmia is that she raises the voice of the voiceless. So when she walks into her AWC, she encounters women who are from war-torn countries like Iraq, Lebanon, Syria, Palestine. She gives them voices. I consider her like my second mother. And even though hardship, she still managed to find time to mentor me. She could have made this all about her, but in her hardship, she still managed time to mentor me, and I really, really appreciate that. And it's an honor being part of the Rasmia Defense Committee because Rasmia is a part of my life, and I don't know how I could ever step away back from that. There's another woman I'd like to thank, and again, I'm using this opportunity. I know I could speak about my work, but this is, I think, the only opportunity where I get to thank these women. One of them, she's not here because it's my mother. My mother's not an organizer, but I have to say how she shaped me and what I was doing. My mother showed me the meaning of womanhood. My mother was a single mother, working two jobs and going to school and raising four of us. My mother showed me through her defiance that a woman could win battles before her. Sorry. I'm weak, I know. but I have to say it. Even though my mom couldn't give us everything, and we struggled financially, she taught me life wasn't about money and capital. And that really shaped my social way of thinking. Again, my mother was not an organizer, but the values she instilled in me brought the work ethic and morals it takes to be an organizer. So today, I dedicate my award, and I'm sorry, I don't cry, and then, well, I do cry in private, but not in front of people, because I like to show that I'm strong, just like Rasmiya. But, oh, thank you, I'm wishing you. Sorry, guys. So today, I dedicate this award to all the single mothers, like my mother, who had to work two minimum wage jobs and go to school. And I dedicate this award to the organizers like Rasmiya who work day and night to fight for our community. I dedicate this award to the teachers who make things happen for their kids under these crazy circumstances. I dedicate this award to the trans women who were killed and their voices are not heard. And I definitely dedicate this award to the mothers who are fighting day and night to bring justice for their children who are lost to state violence and police repression like Dorothy Holmes. Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Paul Kavika Martin of Peace Action, who talks about President Obama's historic visit to Hiroshima and the prominent list of scholars and activists who are asking him to take concrete steps towards nuclear disarmament. Becky Meyer, an anti-frack gas pipeline activist, who considers some of the challenges of not-in-my-backyard attitudes among some fellow property owners who aren't engaged in the larger issue of climate change. And author and activist Tariq Ali, who discusses the growing worldwide movement resisting economic inequality and austerity. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Waves of protests have overtaken Warsaw, Poland, in opposition to the right-wing Law and Justice Party and its nationalist agenda, which took full control of the government last fall. The conservative government, which is seeking a total ban on abortion, received a rebuke from the European Union for exacerbating conflicts with Poland's judiciary and the media. Poland is seen as one of Europe's economic success stories since its entry into the EU. But many conservative rural communities were left behind over the last generation, and they harbor strong resentment against Europe's liberal culture. These rural voters gave the Law and Justice Party Poland's first majority government since the fall of the Berlin Wall. This spring, liberal activists in Poland rose up against the ultra-conservative party and its authoritarian tendencies, which included actions taken to weaken the constitutional court. Three former Polish presidents, including Solidarity leader Lech Walesa, condemned the right-wing government and called on Polish citizens to defend democracy. The Huffington Post reports protests have broken out in Gambia, one of the most repressive nations in Africa. President Yahya Jammeh took power in a 1994 coup in the West African nation of 2 million people. In recent years, thousands of refugees have fled the country to escape atrocities, including the murder of gay men. In mid-April, sustained demonstrations broke out against President Jammeh, who has the loyalty of Gambia's brutal security services and paramilitary groups. Protesters demanded major electoral reforms in advance of upcoming elections scheduled for December. In Gambia's last election in 2011, the European Union and the Economic Community of West African States refused to send election observers due to the brutal repression of opposition party activists. After the first protest in April, protests were attacked by police, and leading opposition leader Solo Sandeng is believed to have died while in police custody. While the crackdown may have been intended to intimidate activists, Sandeng's death and the imprisonment of top opposition leaders caused outrage, and the protest resumed. The European Union and the United States condemned the attacks on protesters, and United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon expressed his dismay. Political gridlock on Capitol Hill has taken its toll on adequately maintaining the nation's roads and bridges. Recent attempts to raise the gas tax to boost funding for the Highway Trust Fund have stalled as the backlog of unfunded transit projects has piled up. By 2025, the price of maintaining and updating the country's infrastructure will total $3.3 trillion, but planned investments are only $1.8 trillion, leaving a $1.4 trillion gap. That shortfall is projected to grow to $5.1 trillion by the year 2040 if spending continues on the current trajectory, according to the latest report from the American Society of Civil Engineers. In launching the post-recession stimulus program in 2009, President Obama boasted of shovel-ready transit projects. Yet in the end, only $105 billion of the stimulus package was spent on infrastructure. Congress last boosted the gas tax in 1993, and the Highway Trust Fund may go broke in a decade without a new infusion of revenue. Last year, Congress passed a five-year transportation bill without increasing the gas tax and relied instead on accounting gimmicks, such as shifting funds from the Federal Reserve. Yet with an increasing number of roads and bridges in disrepair, a dozen states, including conservative enclaves like Georgia, Idaho, and Nebraska, have raised gas taxes. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
Barack Obama will be the first sitting U.S. president to visit the Japanese city of Hiroshima, the site of the world's first atomic bomb attack during the waning days of World War II. Mr. Obama, who will be in Japan for a G7 summit meeting, will tour Hiroshima on May 27th, the city where an estimated 140,000 civilians died after the U.S. dropped the atomic bomb on August 6, 1945. A second American nuclear bomb targeted the Japanese city of Nagasaki on August 9th. Japan surrendered less than 1 week later. The president says that his visit to Hiroshima will emphasize the friendly ties between former enemies, but that he would not apologize for America's use of nuclear weapons against Japan's civilian population. While a majority of Americans see the bombings as justified to end the war and save lives, a view disputed by many historians, most Japanese believe that the use of atomic weapons wasn't justified, according to public opinion polls. In response to the president's announced visit to Hiroshima, more than 70 prominent scholars and activists, including Noam Chomsky, Daniel Ellsberg, and Oliver Stone, signed a letter calling on Mr. Obama to take concrete steps towards nuclear disarmament during his remaining months in office. Some of those signatories opposed the president's support for spending $1 trillion over the next 3 decades to build a new generation of U.S. nuclear weapons and delivery systems. Your reporter spoke with Paul Kavika Martin, communications and political director with the group Peace Action, who talks about the significance of President Obama's visit to Hiroshima and the letter calling on him to take action to move the world closer to the abolition of nuclear weapons.
This is the first sitting president to visit Hiroshima. It is a big deal to the Japanese. If you look at any Japanese media, they are going crazy over there about this visit. They celebrate this and commemorate this very intently with tens of thousands of people attending the commemorations in August. And, you know, they have expectations of what this might mean to them. So it will be interesting to see exactly what Obama's remarks are and what he does when he's there.
Paul, your group, along with more than 70 scholars and activists, signed a letter in support of the president's trip to Hiroshima, but called upon him to use his remaining months in office to take substantive action to move the world closer to the abolition of nuclear weapons. Maybe you could talk about this letter and specifically what you and the other signatories want the president to move towards while he's still got some time in office.
Sure. I mean, the president deserves praise, not only this trip, but he also put together and pushed forward through the Senate the passing of a new START treaty that reduced the number of strategic warheads that the U.S. and Russia both have now to like 1,550. He also pushed through last year the Iran agreement that has put Iran from having the capabilities of possibly putting together a crude nuclear weapon in 3 months to now over a year, plus having verification and monitoring of their nuclear program, which will keep them from having a nuclear weapon in the immediate future. And he's also held a number of nuclear security summits that have done things to close the loop on loose nukes and nuclear materials to make sure it doesn't get in the wrong hands. That's all great. On the other hand, the administration has been putting forth a plan to upgrade all of our nuclear warheads and all the delivery systems, bombers, submarines, and missiles, to the tune of about $1 trillion over the next 30 years. So in one hand, he's saying, let's get rid of these things and have a world free of nuclear weapons. But on the other hand, we're funding, upgrading, and building them into the indefinite future. So certainly a couple of steps he could take would be, one, let's reduce that funding. He can start with a simple thing, which is there's funding to try to build something called a new nuclear cruise missile. It's called the long-range standoff missile. That could be cut in some sort of a way. I mentioned our strategic warheads. Many in the military say we can get down to 200, 300, 400 strategic warheads and still have a deterrent. So he could cut and put a challenge to Russia to also cut, but he could go easily from 1,500 to 1,000, which the Pentagon has already approved, or even deeper cuts there. That's something he can do. And a lot of people don't know that we still have our warheads set on something called hair trigger alert, which means if we think that we're being attacked, the president could actually launch a nuclear weapon within about 10 minutes. That puts a lot of pressure on someone. This hair trigger alert is also in Russia. Mistakes have happened where we've actually thought that we were being attacked here in the U.S. at one point, where the National Security Advisor Brezhnev was about to call the president to say we were being attacked and find out that it was actually a false alarm. So there's several of those things have happened. So he could actually take nuclear weapons off hair trigger alert. And lastly, we also have several thousand warheads called reserve in case something goes wrong with the warhead, you can replace it. We really don't need several thousand to replace 1,500. We can start dismantling. So a number of things he could do to push us towards going to zero, and then also, you know, reaching out to Russia, even in this hard time of our relations between us and Russia. This is something that Russia might even agree to and actually could help relations with us and Russia, is to reach out for some sort of another agreement. So there's a long list of things he can do. We hope that he at least talks about one or two of these in the coming weeks and actually takes action before he leaves office.
That was Paul Kavika-Martin, Communications and Political Director with Peace Action. Learn more about the scholars and activists calling on President Obama to move toward nuclear disarmament by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Across the United States, proposed frack gas pipelines are being canceled, even as many more such projects are applying for permits through the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, which must first grant a certificate of public convenience and necessity to enable these projects to be built. Those pipeline projects that have been canceled or suspended and not likely to be revived include the Northeast Energy Direct Pipeline that would have traversed the states of Pennsylvania, New York, Massachusetts, and New Hampshire, the Constitution Pipeline in Pennsylvania and New York, and the Pacific Connector Pipeline in Oregon. Reasons for the cancellations vary, from a lack of customers to buy the gas, to the failure of companies to win permits through state health regulators. In every case, however, opposition by local residents and homeowners has been critical to these victories. In these fights, some opponents have always emphasized the need to move away from all fossil fuels in order to curb climate change. But much of the passion and the big numbers turning out for anti-pipeline hearings have come from homeowners who didn't want the pipelines crossing over or near their property. Many, in fact, were less concerned with the issue of climate change. This familiar attitude is often referred to as NIMBY, or not in my backyard. Now that several of these pipeline projects are no longer a threat, some activists who worked on these campaigns are coming together in an effort to convince their neighbors to join them in taking on the larger issue of climate change. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Becky Meyer, a New York State resident who was active in the campaign opposing the Northeast Energy Direct pipeline. Here she explains some of the challenges of NIMBY attitudes and how she plans to appeal for a united front to address climate change.
All along, we wanted to be doing two things simultaneously, fighting the gas pipeline and creating the alternative. The fight part took all of our time and energy. So now we have 1,500 people on our mailing list. We've, you know, had up to 340 people come to our meetings. We have a lot of people who have been educated about the problems with fossil fuels and the concerns about climate change. And initially, the impetus for many of these people was NIMBY. But we really all along really talked about the problems with fracking, about the environment, about the communities where they were fracking and the Marcellus shale fields, that this was bigger than just saving their backyard. And we really developed a group of passionate fighters. And so we want to garner that energy to continue and beyond the NIMBYism.
You mentioned doing a lot of education and networking going forward. Is there anything else you hope to do?
I'm hoping to, and there was a lot of enthusiasm in this as I've talked to people about it, to organize a renewable fair. Because so many of us, you know, it's on our list to switch our electric bill to some renewable source or to insulate the house or to get free energy audits from the electric company. But I know I didn't do it until this whole thing came up. So we want to have a big energy fair where we bring all the local resources that people can use to change their use of fossil fuel to renewables. Because the more of a more people that are doing that, the more it will happen. So that's continue educating people, keep them involved by doing small things, and then really concentrate on how we can switch to a renewable future.
Becky Meyer, you talked about NIMBY, that idea of not in my backyard, and how that was the motivation for a lot of people. Can you draw that out a little bit? What did that mean for people getting involved or not getting involved? And how did that affect you directly because you got involved?
Well, I think most of the people who were initially involved, the pipeline was actually going to come either on their property, through their property, or close to their property. So they were scared of what it would do to their property values, what it might do to their health and safety, and how particularly we were going to have a compressor station in Rensselaer County. And so the people around there were, you know, much more concerned even than the pipeline. And and we had done meetings about the health effects of the compressor station and the possibilities of leaks and explosions. I mean, the number of people who just said there is such a relief, they feel they can stay in their home. Some people were thinking about leaving their homes, but worried about resale value even if they did. And just an incredible sense of personal relief for their everyday life. Sometimes people try to move the pipeline away from their community, and we kept saying, you know, that's not our focus, because then we're just going to make some other group of people as miserable as you are now. We really have to fight against the need and the necessity for a pipeline rather than just move it from one place to another. And I think people really began to understand that rally cry And I think the number of people who have talked about wanting to continue this fight is very impressive. So even though their home is now not in jeopardy, they still feel some responsibility to the larger community.
Do you think that people need to up the ante and take bolder action around climate change?
Toward the end of this fight, I was inching into, I think we need to start talking about some nonviolent civil disobedience, and could we get somebody to come out and give us some training, and could we inch into that direction? So we weren't there, and even myself, I'm somewhat cautious and concerned. You know, we had a veterinarian who said, you know, I can't, if I'm ever arrested, I will lose my license. So, you know, there were lots of legitimate concerns. I'm very glad that there are people doing that. Whether or not it's something that I personally am either comfortable with or feel is the best way, I think it's really important, and I think it's uncomfortable, and there is definitely backlash that you need to deal with, but I do believe that most of the real changes that have happened in our country often have needed that level of involvement.
That was Becky Meyer of the group Stop the New York Frack Gas Pipeline. Find links to groups opposing gas pipeline projects and related information by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. There's no doubt that we're living in a time where there's enormous discontent, if not anger, about the failure of both our political and economic systems here in the U.S. Millions of working people across the country have seen their standard of living steadily decline. And what's worse, parents see a future where their children will likely have less economic opportunity and security than they did. In short, what we're seeing is the bubble bursting on the so-called American dream and the erosion of the middle class. This year's presidential election campaign, with both the unexpected victory of Donald Trump among GOP voters, responding to appeals to racism and xenophobia, and the unforeseen enthusiasm for Bernie Sanders' progressive campaign, reflect the crumbling edifice of the major two-party duopoly. Many Americans, who see the current political system as corrupt and working against their interests, are now eager to support outsiders to shake up the status quo. In addition to the brief jolt of energy and consciousness raised by the Occupy Wall Street movement here in the U.S. in 2011, uprisings against economic conditions have been cropping up across the world in recent years. While new left movements have organized in Spain, France, Italy, and Portugal, the anti-immigrant right has also gained support, mainly in response to rising Islamophobia and a flood of refugees arriving from Syria and other conflict zones. Tariq Ali, a British writer and filmmaker who has written more than 24 books on world history and politics, recently spoke at New York City's annual Left Forum conference, where he addressed the topic of capitalism and militarism at humanity's peril organizing our power. Here we present an excerpt of Ali's talk, where he focused on the growing worldwide movement resisting economic inequality and austerity policies.
Very glad to be here, especially at this time, because though we're talking about the presidential candidates, Senator Clinton and Donald Trump, what has really been exciting, watching what is going on from afar in the United States, has been these huge mobilizations of young people in favor of a candidate who talks of socialism. We can now, and what I want to tell you is that this movement of young people, which has brought many more people together than one could have imagined, much larger than any political campaign I remember involving trying to go for it against the mainstream, than at any other time in recent American history. The Vietnam, anti-Vietnam War movement didn't create a political side to it. even though Martin Luther King was talking of running as an alternative president, not inside the Democratic Party, but together with Dr. Spock challenging the Democratic Party. That didn't happen. One reason it didn't happen is he was killed. So what we are witnessing is a very interesting radicalization, and it's a radicalization of young people which is happening in most countries in Europe today. Why? Since the 2008 Wall Street crash, many people felt, especially those who had absolutely no idea or no alternative view, that somehow the governors of the world, the rulers of this world, capitalist world, would manage to put something new in place that would give some comfort to the poor and to the young, who suffer even more on many levels. Lack of housing, too much to pay for education, and increasingly in some parts of Europe, health as well. Though we have national health services, they are under very heavy fire and attack from American health corporations who are increasingly being given contracts by state-owned health services as part of the neoliberal system. So in this situation, it was felt that if the elites who rule the world were a bit more rational, they would attempt to put in place something different, something that had been tried before. It didn't happen. And after a short wait, you had the emergence of new popular movements from the left, and you had the emergence of mass movements from the right. This process began in different ways in different countries, but we can now see a pattern, as we can see in the United States too. And this pattern is as follows. All these movements had one thing in common. They developed from the grassroots. They developed often in one part of the country, either a region, Sicily in the case of the Five Star Movement, Madrid in the case of the occupation of the squares in Spain, and then spread rapidly from there to the rest of the country. We've been witnessing now, even as I speak, the rise of a new popular movement in France, again a movement which pushes all the established political parties to one side and says, we don't trust you. Or the intellectuals who serve these parties, we don't trust you. Keep away, move away. And we want to unite with trade unions to fight against the new laws that the French socialist government, so-called, is bringing and putting onto the statute book to restrict labor rights in France. And this movement comes together at night. Some of them work during the day. Others think it's a nice time to do it, to occupy the night, la nuit debout, the night rising. And they meet. And increasingly, this movement, which started in Paris, is spreading and has spread to other parts of France. There have been clashes with the riot police, etc., etc. We live in a very strange world, a world of transition in which the system that is in place is not working. Everyone knows it's not working. We know it's not working, and those who run the system know it's not working. Because were it working even a tiny bit, then all these jokers in Wall Street, the bankers who stole money, half of them would be in prison for what they did.
That was an excerpt of a talk by Tariq Ali, a British writer and filmmaker, speaking at the annual Leftform Conference in New York City on May 20th. Find links to related articles and additional recordings from the Leftform by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines,
a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show, which is celebrating 25 years on the air in 2016. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Richard Hill, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
For the love of Yuri. Recently, Pennsylvania's Republican senator announced his opposition to a computer corporation's honoring of the late activist Yuri Kochiyama. Kochiyama, in her long and eventful life, fought for many things, among them this commentator's life and freedom. By attacking her, this senator sought to attack me, but it appears his aim was off, for after all is said and done, he only succeeded in besmirching himself. Here's why. Pennsylvania's Republican Senator Patrick Toomey attacked the memory of a woman who has become a legend in the minds of many. For if anybody knows anything about freedom and its cost, it isn't Toomey, a thin-lipped, mediocre politician who began as an investment banker. It's Yuri, who, when just a little girl, was thrown, along with her family, into an American concentration camp for the high crime of being Japanese in a racist white nation. When she grew up and married Bill Kochiyama, she was active in the civil rights movement, fighting for social justice for black children. She later joined the Black Liberation Movement, and in one of the most touching moments of that movement, when Malcolm X was assassinated, the young Japanese woman holding Malcolm's head as he breathed his last, that was Yuri. She would later support a plethora of freedom movements, yes, including this commentator's, because who best to fight for freedom than those who know the absence of it? When most little girls played with rag dolls or tossed jacks, little Yuri, who used to sing, "My country, 'tis of thee, sweet land of liberty," looked around her and saw barbed wire, armed guards, and dry, barren earth blowing tumbleweeds. This sensitive, beautiful little girl, an American citizen, mind you, born in the USA, saw the scowling faces of fear and armed hatred in the visages of American troops and the even uglier politics of rabid right-wing racists who made such cruel concentration camps possible. The question arises, who is more worthy of honor, Yuri Kuchiyama, a lifelong freedom fighter, or Patrick Toomey, a narrow-minded politician trying to play his off-note of fear for political advantage? We love Yuri Kuchiyama. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. Today, on the issue of the Second Amendment, self-defense, and the left, I am in contemplation over an editorial cartoon from that old journal, Harper's Weekly, of October 28, 1876, by A.B. Frost. No, I don't have a library that extensive, nor a computer. It was reprinted in the San Francisco Bay View. And the cartoon wasn't so much clever as it was revelatory, for it could have been drawn today. It showed a tall, rangy, bearded figure holding a smoking pistol in his right hand and a bayonet in his left. Beneath him is the fallen figure of an emaciated black boy clad in rags, clearly dead. This cartoon bears a legend. In bold print, it reads, "Self-defense." The bearded white man, identified as Southern Chivalry, states, "If I hadn't killed you, you would have grown up to rule me." Think about that. That was the voice of self-defense in America during the age of Reconstruction. Actually, it was a voice of self-defense in white America. Blacks had a decidedly different voice, and what it said is that self-defense is a human right practiced throughout history and shown by groups as divergent as the Deacons for Defense, headquartered in Louisiana, but active throughout the South, to the first year of the Black Panther Party, born in Oakland as the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense. It was party co-founder Huey P. Newton who, in his 1967 essay, In Defense of Self-Defense, called for the arming of black people to defend themselves from the repression of the state. Men, Huey explained, were not created to obey laws. Laws were created to obey men. Every law throughout American history was designed to disarm black people while arming whites. That tension lies at the heart of any discussion of the Second Amendment, which ostensibly protects the right of the people to keep and bear arms. One wonders, what people? Even today, we see that such a constitutional guarantee doesn't extend to black people today. Remember Tamir Rice, that beautiful little boy in Cleveland, killed by cops for possessing a toy gun? An armed black person is a target. An armed white person? Or normality. That, my friends, is our reality. Yesterday, 1876, 1966, 2006, and 2015. The right to arms is as speculative as the right to self-defense. I thank you all. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. We'll be right back. final fig leaf. As elections near, voters face the choices before them with something like dread. Donald Trump, loathed, loud, bellicose, rich as Croesus, and xenophobic, or the presumptive Democratic nominee, unless Vermont's Bernie Sanders can upend her, Hillary Rodham Clinton, slick as oil, flexible as a slinky, bottled blonde ambition, and wife of the proverbial political animal, Slick Willie Clinton. Both options have eyebrow-raising negative ratings. In a word, it's a battle between nasty versus crafty. Ultimately, the race may come down to who is hated least. Indeed, this election may reveal voters choosing a victor by voting not so much for one, but voting against the other. Trump seems to trumpet his meanness, almost as posting a sign. No Mexicans, no blacks, no broads, and no chinks need to vote for me. Hillary, as co-architect of the prison industrial complex, has shown up in more black churches than the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. She's eaten pork chops, quoted Sojourner Truth, and tried to sing Negro spirituals to lure black voters. Sadly, millions of black voters will opt for Clinton, who helped cause more black pain on a vast scale than any antebellum slave owner. Thank goodness for black youth who, as Black Lives Matter, bucked their parents to raise a burning social issue, mass incarceration. Unlike virtually any constituency in America, we vote for who we find comfortable and demand nothing. Other constituencies demand discreet, clear policies and get them. We vote like children in a grocery store for bright, shiny, glittering things, you know, sugar cereal. If Hillary Rodham Clinton gets elected, it'll be because of black voters rewarding a politician for a policy of repression. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Why has it been so difficult to get an accurate account of the facts surrounding the situation in Ukraine? How significant was the shooting down of Malaysian Airlines Flight 17 to the West's ambitions for Ukraine? In what ways have the investigation of MH17 been compromised? Is there any credibility to reports of human rights abuses by Russians in Crimea and Donbass? How is the recently announced prisoner exchange likely to play out in the context of the broader conflict? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we get some updates on the turmoil gripping Ukraine. Investigative journalist Robert Perry talks about U.S. government and mainstream media obfuscation, particularly of the investigation into the shooting down of MH17. And then Vancouver-based writer and activist Roger Annis shares his analysis of the past, present, and future of the country. On this week's program, breaking through the media fog on Ukraine, MH17, and Cold War 2.0. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of May 27th, 2016. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. If Trump becomes U.S. president, there is some possibility, perhaps, that the neoconservatives will cease to dominate U.S. foreign and military policies. Should this turn out to be the case, the Russian nationalists might ease their pressure on Putin to remove the Atlanticist integrationists from the government. If Hillary becomes U.S. president, the neoconservative threat to Russia will escalate. The Atlanticist integrationists will be eliminated from the Russian government and Russia will move to full war standing. As I have previously written, pushing Russia to war means the demise of the U.S. and Europe and, considering the destructive power of nuclear weapons, most likely of all life on Earth. That comes from the article, Will the November U.S. Presidential Election Bring the End of the World? By Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, posted May 25th, originally appearing at Paul Craig Roberts, IPE. The way Germany sees it, the IMF is supposed to lend Greece the money with which to repay the private German banks. Then the IMF is to be repaid by forcing Greece to reduce or abolish old age pensions, reduce public services and employment, and use the revenues saved to repay the IMF. As these amounts will be insufficient, additional austerity measures are imposed that require Greece to sell its national assets, such as public water companies and ports, and protected Greek islands to foreign investors, principally the banks themselves or their major clients. So far, the so-called creditors have only pledged to some form of debt relief, not yet decided, beginning in 2 years. By then, the younger part of the Greek population will have emigrated and will have been replaced by immigrants fleeing Washington's Middle Eastern and African wars, who will have loaded up Greece's unfunded welfare system. That comes from the article, We Have Entered the Looting Stage of Capitalism, once again by Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, posted May 26th, originally appearing at Paul Craig Roberts, IPE. On the eve of President Obama's April 2016 visit to Saudi Arabia, the U.S. Congress began debating the Justice Against Sponsors of Terrorism Act, or JASTA, that would, inter alia, allow the families of victims of the September 11th attacks to sue the Saudi government for damages. Also in April 2016, the New York Times published that a 2002 congressional inquiry into the 9/11 attacks had found that Saudi officials living in the United States at the time had a hand in the plot. The commission's conclusions, said the paper, were specified in a report that has not been released publicly. on April 28, 2016, the London-based Saudi daily Al-Hayat published an exceptionally harsh article on this topic by Saudi legal expert Khatib al-Shamari, who argued that the U.S. itself had planned and carried out 9/11 while placing the blame on a shifting series of others, first Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, then Saddam Hussein's regime in Iraq, and now Saudi Arabia. He wrote that American threats to reveal documents that supposedly point to Saudi involvement in 9/11 are part of standard U.S. policy of exposing archival documents to use as leverage against various countries, which he calls victory by means of archives. That comes from the article, State Sponsors of Terrorism, U.S. Planned and Carried Out 9/11 Attacks But Blames Other Countries for Them, out by MEMRI, Middle East Media Research Institute, posted May 25th, originally appearing at the website for the Middle East Media Research Institute. Modern monetary theory, which is associated with outstanding economists such as Michael Hudson, makes it clear that countries should finance their infrastructure and any productive investment by creating money, not debt. The use of government debt simply allows private banks to create the money, and the debt has to be serviced with interest paid to the banks, which drains the economy of spending power. Moreover, the debt can end up in hostile hands and be used to destabilize the economy. If Russia is going to allow the West to control its economy, it may as well allow Washington to control its armed forces. Unfortunately for the Russian government and the Russian people, Russia's central bank and neoliberal economists are too naive and gullible to be able to protect Russia from destabilization. That comes from the article, Will Russia Succumb to Washington's Economic Attack? By Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, posted May 26th, originally appearing at Paul Craig Roberts IPE. Is it coincidence that Berlin approves and even recommends the hostile takeover of Monsanto by the German agro and pharma giant Bayer? Or is another occult strategic arrangement between Washington and its vassal-in-chief of the EU, Berlin, to push the nefarious Europe-destructive TTIP, that's the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, down the throat of the European population? Under the secretly negotiated TTIP, corporations such as Monsanto would prevail over public opinion. The laws of the corporations, which would bring along their own private court system, would be weighing in above the national courts of sovereign EU members. In fact, any public protests in the streets could be violently oppressed by police and military forces very legally, because a signed and approved TTIP could become the law of the land, hence to be enforced by martial law, if necessary, against the will of the people. That comes from the article, Germany Buys Monsanto and Sells the TTIP to Europe, by Peter Koenig, posted May 25th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Robert Perry is an investigative journalist who broke several of the Iran-Contra stories for Associated Press and Newsweek back in the 1980s. And through the online media outlet ConsortiumNews.com, he's maintained a high standard of reporting on stories which challenge the mainstream narratives. He's focused much of his writing on the situation in Ukraine since the coup of 2014. Robert Perry now joins us from Arlington, Virginia. So thank you very much for being part of our program, Mr. Perry.
Well, thanks for having me.
Okay, so we're going to discuss a little bit about the situation in Ukraine, and particularly the shootdown of MH17. But I just wanted to kind of get your thoughts, first of all, given your long background in journalism. I know in my very, very, very short time as a broadcast journalist, I've found that there's been few narratives out there that seem to compare with the kind of the wool that seems to be pulling over our eyes around Ukraine, and in terms of the way that dissenting opinions seem to be shut down. I mean, there's a virtually universal you know, like all parties in when the Canadian Parliament, the U.S. Congress, there seems to be an overall consensus of opinion about the fascist dictatorial Putin and you know the situation of U.S. NATO, if anything, kind of coming to the defense against Russian aggression. Is there anything in your experience that compares with it? Because I mean, even with the Iraq War, there seemed to be much more of a dissenting in opinion, at least in my recollection. But what are your thoughts about how distinct the Ukraine narrative has been?
Well, I think it's always the biggest danger that really democracies face when there becomes this groupthink that just dominates how some issue is seen. We did see this with the Iraq War. Yes, there was perhaps a bit more dissent, although there was in terms of the major institutions in Washington. Almost all the major news organizations lined up behind believing that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. You know, the New York Times, the Washington Post, you just go down the line pretty much. There were a couple of dissenters in there, but not much. The same mostly with Congress. There was a great fear about being accused of being a Saddam apologist, so people didn't dare argue that perhaps Saddam Hussein wasn't hiding weapons of mass destruction, because everything was so easy to just pile on and join this groupthink. And there was safety in numbers. As it turned out, even when all those journalists were wrong, and many of those politicians were wrong, there was very, very little accountability. Many of the same people are still running major news organizations today or holding down key jobs. Fred Hyatt, for instance, who's the editorial page editor of the Washington Post, he was in that job back in 2002, 2003, got everything wrong, but he's still there shaping how Washington views the world. So it's a great danger whenever you get into this demonizing of foreign leaders, taking it way beyond what the facts actually present. There's always this tremendous fear that you're going to be called someone's stooge or someone's apologist. So people shut up, and they don't examine the facts carefully and objectively. And what we try to do at Consortium News is to just ignore all that pressure and just try to look at the evidence as it's presented. We try to get the various government agencies to release information that can further clarify key incidents. We don't just pile on and go with the flow and take part in the groupthink. And I know we get attacked for that a lot, but that's what journalism is supposed to do. It's not supposed to simply be part of the jump on the bandwagon. You're supposed to, you know, even when someone's unpopular, even when someone's hated, still give that person the same fair shake that you give anybody else. The real problem with Ukraine is it's become this sort of ground zero for what they call information warfare. And so it's very hard to know what's real. Mm. And everyone's trying to push to get, you know, their edge. But we've tried to approach this in a way of saying, here's what we see. Here are the facts that back up what we see. And leave it at that. Whether people don't like it, well, that's life of being a journalist sometimes.
I wanted to focus on one aspect in particular of that sort of information war taking place around Ukraine, and that has to do with the firing or the shooting down of the Malaysian Airline Flight 17 on July 17th of 2014. It seems to be a fairly critical narrative, but I wonder if I could get your comments. I mean, I'd like to drill down on a couple of details, but just if you could just express how critical, how key is that narrative about it, about Russian-backed rebels, quote-unquote, having been responsible for that tragedy. How critical is that to the overall narrative around Ukraine and U.S. designs there?
Well, there have been a couple of key turning points in the whole Ukraine story where the way the Western media has reported it and what the facts seem to be as best they can be determined at this point don't mesh up. There was, for instance, before the coup back in February of 2014, there was a sniper attack. And immediately, the U.S. government and the Washington Press Corps and the Western Press Corps in general blamed it on the then embattled President Yanukovych. The evidence, as it's been very, very hard to get to the evidence in some ways, because the government that took over from Yanukovych has not wanted to seriously investigate this. But the evidence seems to point to some element of the right wing having fired on both police and on demonstrators to just touch off what became a very bloody conflict. So the evidence that, as I say, some of this is hard to pin down, but you sort of piece things together and try to look at it objectively, it looks more like that was the case. And that is even the view of some people in the European Union, in their foreign policy centers, that this was not something done by Yanukovych. It was done by some people trying to provoke a more severe crisis in Ukraine. Now, so that was an important point. Then we had a similar one. Then after this conflict begins, there's a civil war, there's the Crimeans vote to leave Ukraine because they feel embattled. They're mostly ethnic Russian, and they vote to go back to Russia. Russia accepts that. That's called, in the Western press, that's called a Russian invasion. But then you get to in July, when there's been fighting in the east, which is also the ethnic Russian area of Ukraine. They're resisting this new nationalistic government, Ukrainian government in Kiev. An offensive is underway. The Ukrainian military is making great strides, really, in pushing back the rebels into their territory. And for some reason, there's still commercial airline flights going over eastern Ukraine. They've not been stopped, even though it's an active war zone. And one of them, Malaysian Airline Flight 17, is shot down, killing 298 people. And the question then becomes, well, who did it? Immediately, frankly, my first impression was that it was probably the rebels, because they had shot down some sort of low-lying planes coming in for landing, military planes. So I think that was my initial thought, like a lot of people. But I did, so I consulted with a person who has access to U.S. intelligence analysts, and the person told me, after checking with them, he came back and said, it looks to the U.S. intelligence analysts like it was carried out by some element of the Ukrainian military, possibly an undisciplined group. We know that the Ukrainians had moved their Buk missile systems into the area because they were afraid of a Russian invasion. So I guess that was certainly a possible narrative. But the U.S. government kept pushing this theme that the Russians, the Russian rebels, possibly the Russian government itself, was responsible for this tragedy.
And why is that significant?
Well, because it became the basis for getting the Europeans to get on board with the sanctions that the U.S. government wanted to impose on the Russians. So it basically escalated this new, it sort of pushed us into what we now know as Cold War II, a new Cold War, with all the attendant risks and loss of money and everything else that's going to go into that. So it was always important to figure out exactly what happened, not what was a clever way to make the other guy look bad, but to figure out who was responsible and hold them accountable, whether it was the Russians or the rebels or the Ukrainians, whoever. But that did not seem to be the goal of the U.S. government. It jumped into this and made it into a propaganda weapon. And what was odd is, Secretary of State Kerry goes on the shows, Sunday shows, that following Sunday, the shootdown was on a Thursday. So 3 days later, Kerry's on there trying to pin the blame on the Russian rebels and implicitly the Russian government. And he's saying, we know where this rocket was fired from and so forth. Then a couple of days past that, the U.S. government put out a report which tried to bolster Kerry, but it was quite clear that they had no information that the Russians had provided a Buk missile system to the rebels. There was also one of the analysts who was brought out for some of the mainstream reporters to talk to on background said that maybe the guy who fired it had been a defector from the government and changed sides and then fired the missile. So there was a lot of confusion, clearly. And I kept checking back, and this source would go back and get updates. And as the U.S. government, as the intelligence analysts went back into the details of this, both the satellite intelligence and electronic intelligence, and tried to figure out what happened. What the source was being told by some of these analysts was that it appeared to have been an element of the Ukrainian military, basically broken off a rogue part, working with one of the Ukrainian oligarchs who had carried out this attack. But that obviously would not have fit with the narrative that the United States wanted people to believe. And so what we saw from that 5 days after the event, when in those first 5 days the U.S. government's trying to pin the blame on the Russians, after that the U.S. government goes silent. Mm-hmm. And the U.S. government has refused to provide updates. It's refused to give briefings to reporters on what it knows. It's withheld information from the Dutch investigation. The Dutch were assigned to lead the investigation because the plane took off from Amsterdam. So you have this remarkable case of the U.S. government claiming to have known exactly where the missile was fired from 3 days after the attack, and now almost we're getting on to close to 2 years after the event, and the Dutch investigators still don't know where the missile was fired from.
You know, you mentioned the 279-page Dutch report from October of last year. And of course, there's this missing information from the U.S. government. But I was wondering, are there any other significant omissions or were there any other ways in which that investigation was compromised, in your view?
Well, there are problems because the Ukrainian government was brought into these investigations under some peculiar proviso that any of the countries involved in the investigation, and there are several, Australia, for instance, is involved, and Malaysia, of course, is involved, and the Dutch and so forth. So there are several governments involved, but each one can prevent any information that they wish from being released publicly. So if the Ukrainian government is a suspect in the case, they're essentially being allowed to be involved in running the investigation and deciding what goes to the public as well. So that's certainly an unusual element to this investigation. But there was another interesting point that was released, an appendix to the Dutch Safety Board report, which was widely ignored at the time. But it was a report from the Dutch Intelligence Service, or at least a report based on the Dutch Intelligence Service's information, in which the Dutch authorities say that there were several of these powerful anti-aircraft missile systems in eastern Ukraine at the time. All the operational ones were under the control of the Ukrainian government as of July 17th, 2014. So you had what Western intelligence apparently was saying, because the Dutch intelligence is essentially NATO intelligence, is that based on their information, the only weapon systems capable of shooting down MH17 on July 17, 2014, were under the control of the Ukrainian military. Now, they could be wrong on that. I mean, there could be, you know, I suppose they could have been mistaken, but this was something that was released last October. It's been written about some more recently because it was sort of ignored at first. It was, one of the appendices to this long report. But So we have this problem. So while there's plenty of information on the internet and elsewhere, sort of trying to pin the blame on the Russians, the official information, as far as we have it, is either inconclusive or points toward the Ukrainian government being responsible. Now, the point I've tried to make is, why on earth can't the U.S. government just release this material? They claim it's classified, that it's something they can't release because of state secret reasons. But, you know, it's kind of a silly argument because everyone knows the United States has spy satellites, and we know pretty much what those capabilities are, that they're very good cameras on them, and they have infrared capability for things like explosions. They can track missile launches, things of that sort. That's what they're for.
I'm sure they'd be happy to release that information if it served their propaganda purposes.
Well, one can assume that. I mean, because they were releasing information when there was still confusion within the U.S. intelligence community as to what happened. As the U.S. intelligence community got more refined knowledge of what happened, the U.S. government stopped releasing anything. And I think that's pretty extraordinary, because this was a This was a major airline disaster. In most airline disasters, there's tremendous cooperation among all parties to figure out what happened, because there's the desire is to make sure that the public is safe. These things aren't usually turned into propaganda exercises. And I've spent time with the Dutch families, the survivors of people who were killed on that day, and their lives were turned upside down, ruined, destroyed by what happened. And I spent time with them I was at The Hague, where there was a parliamentary inquiry to the Dutch authorities as to why this investigation is being handled in such a bizarre way. And members of the Dutch parliament were asking, why don't you ask for this information relating to the radar and other technical means? Why haven't you asked? This was last February. So this is a year and a half after the event. And the Dutch authorities responsible for the investigation hadn't gotten basic information yet, because they didn't want to ask the Americans for it, because the Americans didn't want to give it to them. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is all very abnormal. And when you see that kind of behavior, as a journalist, obviously you become suspicious, but you want to stay within the facts. But the facts, as we have them to this point, at least in terms of what the government, what government authorities have let out, not only are they basically fairly inconclusive, but what evidence there is tends to point toward this narrative I was told about, that some element of the Ukrainian military was responsible. Hmm. And you can understand that narrative. That narrative would be that all, assuming that it's just sort of an accident on their part, but you have these fairly undisciplined Ukrainian military units, not particularly well trained, rushing to the front with their weapon systems, expecting possibly a Russian invasion, because at that time the rebels were facing annihilation, and the thinking was maybe the Russians would intervene directly to prevent these ethnic Russian rebels from being crushed. So it made sense for the Ukrainians to move their anti-aircraft missile systems up to the border as close as they could. And there was also some talk that President Putin's plane was returning from South America that day, following a similar route, although it went a bit farther north. So I'm told that U.S. intelligence analysts were looking at the possibility that was a motive, that someone thought this was, since the Malaysian plane has very similar markings to the Russian presidential plane, that they thought they were trying to hit Putin, and they ended up hitting a civilian airliner. I mean, so there are different possibilities. I'm not saying I'm not sure which narrative is correct, but there's reason to understand why the Ukrainians might have either made a mistake or had some undisciplined unit fire on something they thought was one thing and it was turned out to be something else. They were afraid also that the Russians might be attacking. They're just the day before, a Ukrainian warplane that had apparently along the border with Russia had been shot down by an air-to-air missile, presumably fired by the Russians. So the tensions were high. And in those sorts of situations, mistakes are made. That's a possibility too. But instead of trying to figure out the actual facts, and I think U.S. intelligence has gone a long way to know exactly what happened, we're being left in this fog. And not just me as a journalist or you as a citizen, the families of the victims have been left in a fog. And many of them are being led to believe that they should go and sue the Russians. Some Australians just this week have decided they're going to sue the Russians for this. But the case is extremely murky. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have to be. It's murky out of choice here, because the U.S. government has made a decision to leave the situation as it is, which I guess they feel is advantageous to their propaganda needs.
Okay. Well, Robert Perry, it's a big topic, and I wish we had a little bit more time to explore it. But I want to thank you for helping to break through that fog and give citizens a much better understanding of these events as they're unraveling. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Robert Perry is an investigative journalist based in Arlington, Virginia. You can find his reports at the website consortiumnews.com. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. Almost 2 years ago, the Ukrainian military began launching an offensive against the Donbass. Tens of thousands have been killed and millions displaced in the wake of merciless bombings and sieges of cities in Donbass and Lugansk. Last Friday, May 21st, Ukrainian President Poroshenko publicly admitted his government's failure to secure those territories by military means. So what are the prospects for peace in this troubled region? And some of the concerns that surround it. Joining us to bring us up to date on events in and around Ukraine is Roger Annis. Roger Annis is a socialist and retired aerospace worker and a longtime champion for peace and social justice causes. He's a contributing editor at the website newcoldwar.org, and his articles have appeared at rabble.ca, counterpunch.org, and, of course, his own website, rogerannis.com. He joins us now from Vancouver. Hello, Roger Annis, and welcome back.
Hi. It's good to be with you.
I just recently looked at a report from South Front, and in which it was talking about some of the about 2 weeks ago, and it mentioned an OSCE report on some of the activities there, including Ukrainian armed forces essentially taking over and consolidating territory in the exclusion zone, which is a violation of the Minsk process, as I understand it. So does this point to possibly a summer offensive? Are we looking at here, or how do you make sense of these sorts of events?
Well, they're definitely reporting from the People's Republics in Donetsk and also in Lugansk a buildup of the Ukrainian military forces near to or along the demarcation line that was set by the Minsk II ceasefire process. Difficult to say, because there's certainly also, you know, reports saying that the Ukrainian military has not been and is not in any shape to return to the kind of military offensive that we saw in 2014 and early 2015. They suffered significant military setbacks during that time, and the overall situation in Ukraine has deteriorated on all fronts since then. But it's hard to predict with this regime in power in Kyiv. Overall, it remains an extremely difficult situation for the people in eastern Ukraine, Donetsk and Lugansk, because the economic embargo by Ukraine against them continues, and they've effectively had to join their economy to the economy of Russia and switch to the use of the Russian currency, and they're heavily dependent on Russian financial and other assistance for survival. So there's no sign that Kyiv is going to reverse that. And the military pressure by Ukraine is, it's quite harsh. They are shelling the residential districts in the areas of the People's Republics regularly. Every day this is happening, and some days are worse than others. You mentioned the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. Well, it has a monitoring mission there in eastern Ukraine, and they report every day on the violations. Their reports are actually understating the problem. There's much better reporting that happens by the Donetsk International News Agency. But, you know, overall, it's a difficult situation for the people in the east. But there are some positive signs emerging. Number one, pressure on the Ukrainian regime to live up to the Minsk II agreement. And that was an agreement of 13 clauses, virtually every one that the Ukrainian regime has failed to live up to. The key one is that they have to recognize the authenticity of the political leaderships in Donetsk and Lugansk and discuss through a process of political recognition, which would eventually also include elections in the two regions. But Ukraine, that is the regime in Kyiv, has so far refused to do this. So that's the key indicator to watch for. as to whether we'll see any substantial change. Now, there was a discussion just several days ago of what's called the Normandy Four. That's the leaders of Russia, Ukraine, Germany, and France. And the Russian government published a brief report on that discussion. It was a phone conversation. And in the report published by the Office of the President of Russia, it was, you know, specifically stated that the shellings of the civilian areas of the Donbass region, as it's called, the shellings by Ukraine must cease. And then we've also seen an important prisoner exchange take place in the region. So the combination of that and I think some positive political signals coming from the political leadership of Donetsk and Lugansk gives me some cause for optimism that, you know, perhaps this regime in Ukraine can be pressured and forced to back off from the worst of the violations and abuses that they've been perpetrating.
I think because it's May, this marks the second anniversary. This month marks the second anniversary of the Odessa massacre, in which in that town of the city of Odessa, a number of individuals were chased into the trade union's building and burned alive and killed by other means in rather a despicable action. And I don't know of much attention being paid to it, certainly not by mainstream media or even mainstream trade unions here in Canada or elsewhere. Do you want to comment on maybe what the legacy of those actions and how it may be playing out in the public sphere?
Yeah. Well, there was very good news this year because there were quite large commemoration event in Odessa itself for the 2-year anniversary of the massacre. 42 people died in the trade union building, either directly from the arson attack, or they were literally beaten to death as some of those who tried to escape from the building, and then others died the same day in the clashes with the right wing gangs that had come to Odessa to provoke a confrontation. So several thousands of people rallied this year to commemorate the event. And there were also, importantly, there were international observers who were there present, both in some cases to express solidarity, in other cases to make sure that a commemoration event could take place safely without violence. The extreme right in the city and in the country tried to disrupt and prevent the commemoration from happening. And the police were, the Ukrainian police, in the city and region were also trying to dissuade people from participating and to prevent the event from happening, but that wasn't successful. So that's a pretty good sign. And also there's been a very interesting development coming out of the Donetsk Republic now, which is that the leadership of the Donetsk People's Republic and specifically the First Minister, Alexander Zakharchenko, have undertaken a series of kind of open line conversations with people in Ukraine using technology similar to Skype. They can't use television because Ukraine has cut off the television signals coming from Russian speaking Eastern Ukraine into Ukraine proper, but they can use this internet technology. So we've now had three of these, you could call them sort of town hall meetings between the leadership of the Donetsk Republic and interested people in Ukraine who want to participate. And so this is a very good sign, I think, that, you know, despite all the blockages created by Ukraine, that such dialogue could be initiated and deepened. Your listeners could go to our website, New Cold War, and read a summary of the latest, a third such exchange that took place between Zakharchenko and the people of the Kherson region. So I'm very encouraged about it because I think that it's really important for the political leaders in Donetsk and Lugansk to kind of convey their message to the Ukrainian people that really they have a common struggle to build a different society, one in which that's not dominated by the wealthy economic elite of Ukraine that repudiates this ultra-nationalist, Russia-hating ideology of the right wing of Ukraine, and that joins together in building a common republic. And they're certainly thinking along these lines in Donetsk and Lugansk, and of course they have many people in Ukraine itself who
want to join with that message. So this is a very, I think, positive piece of news that's come out recently.
On the first anniversary of the tragedy, a number of rallies, vigils, and demonstrations were staged in centers around the world. In Winnipeg, Canada, I was present at one such demonstration near the new Canadian Museum for Human Rights. A handful of individuals stood off to the side and expressed disapproval of the protests and what they considered pro-Putin propaganda. I took the opportunity to record their thoughts.
The referendum was monitored by Europeans. What kind of Europeans? The neo-Nazi far-right parties in Austria, in Denmark, in France, and in Britain. The far right.
A Russian human rights group did an investigation of the referendum, and their report was that the figures were wildly inflated, that this was not a free, fair, anything like that, that this was a farce.
And another thing, 15% of the population was neither Russian or Ukrainian. It was Tartar. And as of now, all the Tartar language radio stations, TV stations, and newspapers have been shut down.
There was a demonstration, not this year, but on the anniversary of the Odessa massacre, and it was a small group of people, mostly of ethnic Russian Ukrainian descent. But there was a couple of people there who you could say were heckling somewhat and held a very different view. And when I went to talk to them, they mentioned things about, particularly about Crimea. And one of them cited this supposedly authoritative report from March of 2015 about human rights abuses in Russian-occupied Crimea. It was written or authored by Andriy Klimenko, who is the chief editor of Black Sea News and the chairman of the supervisory board of Maidan of Foreign Affairs. And incidentally, Black Sea News was one of the media outlets that was on record as not supporting the annexation of Crimea. So I don't know what that might say about the objectivity of this report. But anyway, it was listing a number of discriminatory policies toward the ethnic Tatar minority and the intimidation of independent voices. And it said that the referendum was conducted under occupation conditions with all these Russian soldiers with guns and all that. And So I was wondering, since you've been to Crimea, if I'm not mistaken, and I was wondering what your thoughts were about the human rights situation in Crimea, if there's much foundation there for these concerns.
Yeah, well, this is a familiar theme that they, the supporters of the Kiev regime and the supporters of the coup in February 2014 keep trying to sound, because they're very angry at the outcome of it. Events in Crimea. As I, described, the people of Crimea decided through the referendum in March of 2014 to put an end to the accident of history that had taken them out of Russia or the Russian Federation and placed them in the Ukrainian Federation back in 1954. There are several things to remember about the original referendum in 2014. Crimea was facing the same kind of threat of civil war, which we saw unfold in eastern Ukraine. And so the vote that was held in Crimea was a vote saying, we're not going to allow a civil war to come to our territory. And the only assurance that we can have that this won't take place is to secede from Ukraine and rejoin the Russian Federation. And then any attack by Ukraine would be, an attack of one country on another. So this is, this was the combination of the accident of history where they had been Crimea had been placed in Ukraine without a consultation originally, with this imminent threat that they faced. The other thing about the referendum was that Crimea because of its unique history and place in Ukraine, was the only part of Ukraine that had an autonomous regional and elected assembly. Ukraine is a highly centralized country. It doesn't have provinces with provincial governments. It doesn't have provincial governments similar to what we have in Canada or similar to state governments in the U.S. All the power is in Kiev, but Crimea was the exception because of its unique place in history. And so it was that elected institution of the Crimean people which conducted the referendum in March of 2014. And sure, it was a somewhat of a rushed referendum because they were staring down, a civil war that was being threatened upon them. There's certainly no question that the vast majority of people in Crimea voted in favor of secession, and the polls that had been conducted, including in some cases by Western sources, following the secession decision, as much as a year after the secession decision, the polls showed the Crimean people, confirming that their original decision, that they were satisfied with the outcome, although not necessarily satisfied with, whatever the government is doing then or now in Crimea. That's a different question. Crimea is on the road to economic rehabilitation, to get out of the stagnation that they were facing in Ukraine. And as far as the human rights situation, well, let's remember two things. Firstly, one of the first acts of the new government of Crimea, now seceded from Ukraine and rejoining the Russian Federation, was to make legal in law, with all of the associated rights, education, healthcare, and so on, of three languages, Russian, Tatar, and Ukrainian. Prior to the secession vote, there was only one official language in Crimea, which was Ukrainian. And the people who suffered most from that situation were the Tatar people, who as a result of not having their language in any kind of legal status, had to fight for every square inch of public education in their own language, of other government services in their own language, and so on. Now, the reports that have been issued, for example, by the Atlantic Council, which is a stridently right-wing and pro-Ukraine, pro-coup d'etat in Ukraine institution, speak of human rights violations. We can't sort of confirm or deny a specific individual case that they would raise, as in any country, any citizen, you or I tomorrow, could be up against an abusive policeman, who violates our rights, or could be up against an institution that's insensitive to some issue that's concerned to us. But as a general rule, the notion of kind of systematic violations of human rights taking place in Crimea, and specifically taking place against the Tatar people, is simply bogus. These reports just gather scattered information, which is, are not kind of documented by more credible human rights organizations. And, I don't see the Atlantic Councils of the world going to Crimea itself with, shall we say, neutral observer missions to investigate the situation and then report. They concoct these reports, and they even get documentary films made. Whereas I can say for sure that our, those with whom we're working and publishing our website and, all of the news reports that we watch for very closely paint a very different story, that is of for sure none of the kind of systematic violations of human rights that the supporters of right-wing Ukraine want to convince us are taking place in Crimea.
One of the concerns was the monitoring, and and one of the people suggested that somehow these groups, the monitoring bodies, were quote unquote right wing neo Nazi elements from France and Denmark and so on. I mean, what can you say about the authority and the credibility of those election observers who witnessed the referendum and concluded that this was a fair referendum?
Well, I don't know the specific accounts. I mean, we read the news reports that were published, and you know what? If you read, you don't even have to read between the lines. If you go back and read what the New York Times, the Guardian, some of the major Western media were writing, they all said that this referendum reflected a clear majority sentiment of the Crimean people. You'd have to look closely and find, but I've seen it there often enough. What they say, what they try to argue, is what the kind of overall tenor of the presence of Russia and so on, sort of you could say, almost kind of intimidated people into voting the way that they did. And that just doesn't hold up. I don't think there were that many observers there at the time of the March 2014 referendum. It's too bad that, instead of succumbing to, what I would say are basically propaganda reports on the situation in Crimea, that, people with some authenticity and credibility, didn't go to Crimea and investigate for themselves. And, what they will see in Crimea today is a rather dynamic situation of, very significant investment coming into the region by Russia to make up for all the years of stagnation that Crimea suffered. And this investment is bringing, Crimea's first autonomous energy supply. So they can't be faced with electricity cutoff, which Ukraine imposed on them at the end of last year. They're building a bridge, the first direct bridge connection from Russia to Crimea. Now let's recall, as of, again, late last year, all road transport, commercial road transport between Ukraine and Crimea was cut off by Ukraine. People supporting Ukraine are crying human rights violations, but turning a blind eye to road, commercial road transport, including food, being embargoed, cut off by Ukraine, to where the electricity supply, all of which came from Ukraine, most of which came from Ukraine before, literally the electricity cables supplying Crimea were blown up by the extreme right wing of Ukraine, and the Ukrainian government did nothing. In fact, they said they ratified what was done. So, this is a good and dynamic situation. Certainly not without its problems. And if you want to delve into the Russian language Crimean press, you'll find quite lively debates of people, proposing different courses and critical of what the government is doing. So, I don't give any credibility at all to this attempt to portray Crimea as being some kind of a place of considerable and ongoing human rights violations. On the contrary, this is a place that's moving forward right now, unlike Ukraine, which is in complete economic stagnation and going backwards.
Okay. Now, I wanted to bring up just an event from earlier this week in which there was a prisoner swap, a prisoner exchange involving the convicted Ukrainian paramilitary Nadia Savchenko, and in exchange for the Russian citizens.
This is quite important. Savchenko became was elevated into the status of a folk hero by the authorities in Ukraine. She was a member of the Ukrainian Armed Forces who took a leave of absence in order to join one of the neo-Nazi paramilitary battalions fighting in eastern Ukraine in May of 2014. And she did that because in the early stages of the civil war in Ukraine, the regular Ukrainian army proved to be an unreliable instrument for the extreme right of Ukraine, because these ordinary soldiers simply refused orders to fire on their fellow citizens in the east of Ukraine. And that's really one of the origins of the rise of these extreme right paramilitary battalions. And so people like Nadia Savchenko, joined these battalions because they were angry at the Ukrainian army for not acting like them, accepting this offensive against civilians in the east of the country. And then she was working in a unit which killed through shelling several Russian journalists, and that was the criminal charge for which she was found guilty in a Russian court several months ago now. So her case became a cause célèbre. Now the Minsk ceasefire agreement has a clause which says there should be an exchange of all prisoners on both sides. Ukraine has been stalling on that prisoner exchange, and there have been some exchanges, but it's been dribs and drabs. The majority of people, that the political prisoners that Ukraine is holding, have not been released. They are not willing even to be able to get an exchange from their vantage point, have not been willing to do. On the surface, this exchange, Savchenko was exchanged for two Russians who were accused not of any violent crime in Ukraine, but they were accused of being in Ukraine. They were in Odessa, basically there to express solidarity with the movement in Odessa. And so they were accused of various sort of anti-terrorist clauses. So two Russian citizens, you know, convicted in a court in Ukraine, exchanged for Nadia Savchenko. I like to think there's a lot more to this story that we'll find out in the coming days and weeks, because given the status of Savchenko in Ukraine, it seems not a lot gotten in exchange for her by the Russian government, particularly in a situation where Ukraine is actually in violation of the Minsk agreement by not conducting substantive prisoner exchanges. So I think we might get more good news in the days or weeks ahead on the prisoner exchange front, that there's possibly an element of this agreement which goes deeper than just the three individuals involved. I like to think also that this might take a little bit of the wind out of the sails of the Kiev regime's, very bellicose and militaristic approach, that, here you have this, woman who's been elevated into hero status, heroine status in Ukraine, released by, after being convicted of a very serious crime of complicity in the murder of two Russian journalists, and yet the Russian government agrees to a prisoner exchange. I like to think this will take the wind out of the sails of those who present, Russia as this total monster who's trying to, ruin Ukraine and everything else. So I'm going to keep my fingers crossed and hope that we hear some more good news in the days or few weeks ahead, where we'll see many more exchanges and more difficult for Ukraine more difficult for the Ukraine to buy the silence of Western media as it keeps perpetrating these daily shellings against the people of Eastern Ukraine.
Okay. I think that we've got to wrap it up right about now, Roger. But if there's any maybe an upcoming article or anything like that that you'd like to direct people to.
I could just encourage readers to follow what we're doing on the website. We're putting a lot of daily news and information on the website about the situation in Ukraine. And we're also providing a lot of information about the situation in Turkey and also in Syria, where, Russia's foreign policy, I think, has been playing quite a positive role in trying to put an end to the regime change chaos in the Middle East that was seeking to overthrow the Syrian government. We have very bad political developments in Turkey with this the government there becoming more and more right-wing and turning more and more to violence against the Kurdish people. So there again, I like to think that the positive outcomes of Russian policy are going to be very beneficial to Ukraine, that it's very hard for Ukraine to sell to the world and sell to Western media the idea of an aggressive unruly and untrustworthy Russian government in a situation where it seems pretty clear to the world that Russia is actually doing a lot to try and ratchet down this this regime change policy in the Middle East out of control. So that's another thing I think to watch for in the coming days and weeks.
Roger Annis, thank you very much.
You're welcome. It's been good talking to you.
Vancouver-based Roger Annis is a longtime champion for peace and social justice causes and a prolific writer. He's a contributing editor to the website newcoldwar.org, and his articles have appeared at rabble.ca, counterpunch.org, and, of course, his website, rogerannis.com.
You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.